Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. I was waiting in the hopes that one of our two illustrious vice chairs would be joining us, but I received word he's next door testifying on sage-grouse, so he'll be joining us momentarily, I hope. We're going to jump around on the agenda a little bit and start with a conversation about major projects and long-term discussion of transportation. So I'd like to invite Paul Mather and Carmen forward, please. Thank you for being here. Always have Ms. Forrest say your name for and forward. I almost messed that up. Thanks for coming forward. And maybe if you'd like to kick us off, I know Mr. Mather has a number of videos and photos for us and all that sort of stuff. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Reed, Vice Chair.
They're not here.
No.
Yes.
Offensive members of the committee. My name is Carmen Foer, and I'm the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Policy Advisor for Governor John Kitzhaber. I want to thank you for inviting me to come before you today to continue our discussion about long-term funding needs of the state's transportation system. We all know a safe and efficient transportation system underpins a strong economy and creates healthy communities. It helps us get goods to market, helps workers get to their jobs, and creates a desirable quality of life that attracts and retains talented people to our state. Oregon's strong multimodal transportation system has been a comparative advantage for a heavily trade-dependent economy as we've competed for jobs with other regions and worked to export products from our farms, our forests, and from our factories. Significant investments from previous legislatures in both the preservation of our shared transportation system and multimodal expansion over the past decade has given Oregon a system that better moves people and goods across all modes. This makes Oregon an attractive place to do business, particularly for businesses dependent upon exporting goods to national and international markets. And ultimately, when we look at our transportation system, we must be mindful about how Oregonians are choosing to get around. No matter if someone wants to walk to school, ride a bike to the gym, drive to work, or catch a train to visit a family member, we want to make sure that the mode they choose to go on will get them there safely. But Oregon faces a number of challenges going forward. The resources we have to operate, preserve, and improve our system are significantly constrained due to a number of factors. With people driving less and driving in more fuel-efficient vehicles, gas consumption in our state has fallen. This has reduced revenues into the State Highway Trust Fund. With revenues lagging expectations, the State Highway Fund is fully committed to maintenance, debt service, and agency operations, leaving little left for new projects. And investments from the Federal Highway Trust Fund, the funding source we rely on for construction projects, today is uncertain. The trust fund could become insolvent as early as July. This is significant to Oregon because the funds from this trust fund represent approximately one quarter of ODOT's current budget. So you know Governor Kitzhaber co-led a bipartisan effort with Governor Pat McCrory of North Carolina and 15 other governors in a letter to congressional leaders raising the importance of fully funding the Federal Highway Trust Fund, expressing the significance it has to our state's economies. They noted this situation is creating uncertainty about the viability for the states and their ability to do long-term transportation improvement plans. These constraints in revenue has left Oregon with inadequate resources to meet a number of transportation needs and hinders our ability to keep our surface transportation network in a state of good repair. Now, as the legislature begins to consider the potential of a transportation package in 2015, I would encourage you to consider three main themes. But overarching all of those themes and what's of importance to Oregon is that we put our transportation system on a path of sustainable investments. The first of the three main items I want to talk about is preservation and maintenance. First, we need the resources to adequately preserve and maintain our existing system to ensure the reliability and efficiency of our transportation network overall. We have a responsibility to protect the tens of billion dollars of public investment in the existing transportation system. Deferring routine and preventative maintenance on pavement simply means deteriorated pavement must be rebuilt at a greater cost rather than it would have taken or cost us to just maintain it properly in the first place. Deteriorating bridges will, and has in the past, forced trucks to detour hundreds of miles out of their way to get goods to market, making our economy less competitive, imposing large costs on Oregon businesses, and imposing unanticipated congestion in small towns throughout Oregon. We can pay now to adequately maintain this system, or we'll all end up paying more later in vehicle damage, in higher costs to replace deteriorated bridges, as well as higher costs for deteriorated and crumbling pavement. The second item that you should keep in mind is seismic issues. Oregon must begin to address the massive vulnerabilities in our state's transportation system and to the state's economy in the event of a major earthquake. Oregon is at risk of a large earthquake along the Cascadia subduction zone that would cause widespread disruption of the transportation system, making rescue operations difficult and also have significant long-lasting effects on Oregon's economy. Investing now in a more resilient transportation system by retrofitting bridges and shoring up landslide zones would allow our state to bounce back quickly from a major event, reducing the economic impact substantially. And then the third issue is stable funding for multimodal system. Oregon must provide stable funding for its multimodal transportation options and connections to foster prosperity, enhance mobility, improve safety, and preserve the liability of communities across our state. Public transportation, freight and passenger rail, and marine ports need reliable, predictable, and adequate funding for their operations. While the Connect Oregon program and general funds have provided a needed infusion of multimodal funding, they are not sustainable. Needs range from funding to operate the Amtrak Cascades passenger service to providing better bicycle and pedestrian facilities and to maintaining and expanding transit services for Oregonians across our state. This is particularly important for the rapidly growing senior population here in Oregon. In closing, a strong transportation system is needed to support and sustain our growing economy. The legislature, in partnership with the governor and the citizens of this Oregon, must work together to preserve and maintain our current transportation investments, continue our support for a multimodal transportation system, and prepare for the event of a seismic event. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Foran. I think given that we don't want to keep you from your advocacy with the federal government, we'll do questions now for you and then turn
sure.
to Ms. Mather. Questions for Ms. Foran? In addition to the federal question, which I'll come back, I'd appreciate particularly the three themes as this committee hopefully starts to prepare for the next session and what I hope will be a robust transportation package. One that I like your three themes. I wonder if you could comment on the question around climate and how that does or doesn't fit with the three themes that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, when we're making investments, particularly in multimodal transportation, we're providing those options for Oregonians to choose other modes. One of the things we do know, especially coming out of the last session, is that in both rural Oregon and in urban Oregon, Oregonians are significantly increasing their desire and actual time both walking and biking. Some people aren't choosing to make those trips because they don't believe the system for them to travel on is safe, and that's an important consideration for us to keep in mind. Additionally, it's very important that we make adequate investments in our transit systems. For some people in our state, mobility is an issue. They are just unable to get around in their home communities, or they have to travel to other communities for health care services or other services or even to do shopping. So providing people those alternatives in rural communities, but also to ensure in our suburban and urban areas, we're providing robust transit transit services helps people make choices to maybe not have to take that car trip. We know that reliability, that transit trip's going to be there, and frequency matter in those conversations. And then another piece of that ultimately is looking at our passenger rail service, specifically along the Willamette Corridor. We know that people are more interested in taking train trips, but how important is it that we know that train's going to arrive on time and that train trip is competitive as best as we can make it be with the car in terms of the time to get to destination. And then finally, investments in alternative fuels and the ongoing investments in our EV electric system are significant as people are beginning to choose vehicles that use alternative fuel sources or our electric vehicles. We have to keep our eye to the future, noting that technology is changing in the auto industry. And in order for us to move forward, do we have the right backbone so people can feel if they're going to take those trips, the system they have to connect to a fuel source is reliable?
Thank you. It's worth noting the governor, our governor, was one of eight governors who just signed a multi-state, I'm not sure if I'm using the right word, compact on the electric vehicle agenda as well. So the committee may want to look at that as well. Representative Cameron, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Carmen, thank you for coming. In your analysis or looking forward, is there any consideration taken, for example, you talked about mass transit and the reliability or people relying on it, in the cost that it's taking today and the unfunded liability that's accumulating in, let's say, for example, TriMet, and how that's going to impact infrastructure down the road or be able to even operate that system, mm-hmm. and how that's going to be paid for. Because mm-hmm. we're pushing that off into the future, too. It's just on the books, and it's not an infrastructure. It's a liability.
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, thank you for that question. We in our office have had conversations with TriMet on that issue. I can't speak as in great depth as TriMet can on their process to work down those liability issues. Ultimately, in how we fund transit through our operating expenses that they have and other investments we bring into the system are significant. But at the same time, how we manage the resources they have at their disposal to make sure they can maintain the system that they have is integral. And understanding the, over the long arc of time what those costs are going to be are important to the public. What I hear from residents in the Portland area and from business leaders is that TriMet services have been a business advantage for them for recruiting and retaining people, and then the city's strategies to getting people around and ensuring their transportation system is efficient. It's important for them to have that option that people have bus service and light rail service or other transit services to get around. But at the same time, managing those resources with an eye to being able to operate it over the long period of time is integral if TriMet's going to be able to keep operating at the current capacity it does today. It, you know, operating expenses in the recent past with downturn in the economy has impacted their ability to provide reliable services, but at the same time looking at long-term operating expenses related to unfunded liabilities for benefits has a potential to impact operating services in the future as well.
So what's the plan, and maybe it's not today, but what's the plan to actually change that curve?
Mm-hmm. No problem. Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, I can work with TriMet to get you a concrete answer on their specific plan to reduce their liability costs. And again, I'm not an expert at this point on their long-term plan on how to deal with those issues. Our office is aware of that issue, but I'd rather get you an accurate answer working with TriMet directly.
Note that there's someone from TriMet in the back of the room who's probably also working on that too. At the moment. Yes.
Well, follow up with just, okay, yes, just and Carmen, just so you may want to follow up on this. I know that there was a bill, a couple of sessions, maybe two sessions in a row, to require unfunded liabilities to be amortized over a period of 20 years. And what I was told by TriMet is if they were required to do that, 20 years, we're saying here, of their unfunded liability, I was told that that would just devastate their service today. So what that tells me is that we are continuing a service that my grandkids are going to be paying for today as you ride that system. So I think that's a serious issue that needs to be dealt with within our state, especially in the metropolitan area as we, in my opinion, recklessly continue to go down a road that cannot be sustainable financially.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Thank you.
Other questions? One last one for me then. I think the committee as a whole is probably probably shares the concern you expressed about the federal lack of action. Anything you can share on late-breaking developments or anything we can be doing to encourage them?
Chair Reed, I think hearing clearly from legislators and from governors and local communities about the importance of sustainable investments out of our federal system is important. The inability to do long-term planning, which has been the hallmark of our trust funds in the transportation system, is deleterious to Oregon. It's deleterious to states across the country. It harms our economy. It harms our ability to plan and put good projects on the ground. In the short run, what potentially will happen, you can never fully predict, but Congress will be likely forced to have to backfill the trust fund with some source of funds, be it general funds or other funds that they identify. It's not anticipated at this time that they will come up with a long-term mechanism to pay to meet the obligations out of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. The latest rumors is potentially that could be punted into the lame duck session of this Congress or into the next Congress altogether. To that end, that's in part why it was important for the governor, along with 16 other governors, bipartisan across the country, to really express in a clear voice to Congress the significance it has for our ability to let projects on the ground today. Those are private sector jobs, construction and architecture engineering jobs. Those are firms that provide and supply goods and equipment to those jobs. And it really speaks to our long-term ability to be competitive. And those are foremost in governor's eyes. I think hearing from legislators as well is impactful to members of Congress. And I will say we do have a delegation that is very mindful and our leaders on this issue and are fighting hard to that end. I think not only, you know, sharing your voices to the chorus, but also working with your peers across the country would be helpful. I think around the country there's a lot of unanimity of understanding, but my experience is you need a lot of those voices to be heard inside the Beltway.
I think we're fortunate to have you in your role, given that federal experience you have, and we'll take that advice. Particularly, also appreciate you being here in advance of what I expect will be lots of conversations in the future session.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Mr. Mather. Come to give us some updates, I expect.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm back for a project update on some of the projects that are going on around the state. I'll lead you on a quick tour through a presentation here on some of the major projects that we have underway. I have some new technology I'm going to try to do embedded in my presentation here, so hopefully it'll all go well through this. So knock on wood.
Forgiving audience with respect to that. We appreciate you bringing something new.
Thanks for warning us.
Yes, and so hopefully we'll get through this. So starting out with, back in February, during the legislative session, we had, as you remember, some snow and some ice right preceding the three-day weekend of President's Day, and we actually had rocks come down in the gorge as we experienced a thaw from that and closed Interstate 84 for about 2.5 days. We had our crews, contractor crews, out there working. State of Washington had their own issues on their side on State Route 14. But after 2.5 days, we've got the highway back open again. Cost us about $500,000 to do that work just to get it open. We have another about $2 million it's going to take to actually fix the slide that occurred. So that's just an example of the type of things that we're faced, not part of our normal plan, and we have to make adjustments in our program to deal with. This particular one, we're applying for federal emergency funds, and we're optimistic that we'll get the $2 million needed to fix this slide. This is a significant slide in that it's the last OTIA 3 bridge. Those of you that were around in the 2003 session, we passed the OTIA 3 legislation, 365 bridges over 10 years, $1.3 billion. We've had ribbon cuttings on all those bridges, and we'll have a ribbon cutting on this last one, June 11th, here in a few weeks. And it'll be an exciting time for us and a program that we're very proud of. It's one that we've delivered on time and under budget for the program, and one we'll celebrate a lot.
It seems like a bittersweet moment. I want to pause on that moment. Can you, I've been impressed by that notion of under budget. Can you give us a sense of how much under budget?
Chair Reed, right now we're projecting at least $45 million under budget as we close out some of these major projects. Both the bridge in Eugene and then this bridge are our two largest projects in the program. So we're closing those out and those costs come in. I think we're conservative in that $45 million. We're optimistic it'll be even a little bit more than that.
$45 million under budget.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very good.
So one thing, just talking a little bit about this particular project, it's a very complex project that we had to deal with. When you look at this picture and you stare at as many pictures as I have over bridges over the years, there's a couple key things that are missing out of this picture that you would normally see in a bridge under construction. Normally when we build bridges, we have many structures in the water. We have the existing bridge, we have the new bridge, we have work bridges, we have detour bridges. And in this case, you see essentially just the new bridge and the existing bridge in the water. And the reason for that is we had to find new ways to build this particular bridge is because of what happens to the Sandy River. The Sandy River floods and has pretty significant debris flows that come down. If you build all those bridges that I described, you essentially put a picket fence across the Sandy River, and you have problems like you see here where debris has come down and potentially could take out all those bridges I just described. And so we had to come up with an innovative way to launch those beams across the new piers that we're constructing for the bridge. And so here's some technology that we hadn't used before in Oregon, but launching those piers horizontally, or those beams horizontally across the new bridge with it. So one of the many uniquenesses that we've discovered or developed as part of this program, and many of those we've incorporated into the way we just do business at ODOT. Sunrise Corridor, another project you've heard me talk about, so just a quick update on this one. Again, this is in the Clackamas area, bypassing the congested area in Clackamas at Highway 212 and Highway 205, a very important project regionally as it's an economic hub with many industrial users in the area, an important economic engine of the region as well as the state. This particular project provides a bypass. It's a $130 million project. 100 of that is the JTA project funding that was passed in 09. As you drive on 205 over the last several months, you've seen us constructing a new structure over 205, but taking a little broader view, you can actually see how the new alignment starts to take shape. So if you can follow my arrow here, here's that bridge I just showed you here in the lower left. The new alignment actually takes off of the existing structure here, and it takes an alignment about like this. You can see the new alignment taking shape here. And here's again, the new alignment looking back from the other direction. So you can start to see the alignment of this taking shape. Kerr Contractors out of Woodburn is the contractor, and we're expecting completion of this in 2016. Chute Road, Brookwood Interchange out on the Sunset Highway, Western Washington County, serving the growth that's happening out there in the high-tech area and serving just the increased traffic out there. This is the diagram of what the project will look like, the added loop ramp there in the upper left quadrant, as well as a realignment of some of the roads to increase capacity of that interchange. Here's a picture taken from a few months ago. You can see we've already completed realigning some of those connecting roads and starting, in that left upper left corner, the construction of that new loop ramp. We've had a few difficulties on this project with utilities and our design and conflicts between those two that we've had to work on that has slowed us up a little bit. Wildish is the contractor, and they've been great to work with. We're hopeful this summer we can make up some of that lost time, but we're about a year away from completing this project. There's another shot of some of that work going on from a few months ago. Newburgh-Dundee, another project I've talked about, but a very significant project. Total cost of $240 million, $190 million of that coming from the Jobs and Transportation Act. As I've talked about before, we've divided this project up into many different segments, trying to encourage local contractors to be competitive in the bidding process. We've had two of those contracts already with some of the work that was completed last summer. The two colors, the kind of orange-red and the yellow, represent the two major pieces of the project. Next week, we're going to open bids on the what we call Phase 1D, or the kind of red color there on the left. In a couple months, we'll open bids on the yellow portion, and hopefully we'll pound a golden spike maybe right between the two as the two contractors work to complete that. So here's a short video that's been produced that we use locally to describe the
summer
project, and I thought it does a good job.
Trucks have been hauling dirt, rock, and heavy equipment in and out of Newburg and Dundee as construction of the Newburg-Dundee bypass is well underway. While there is much work left to do, the project is making progress and moving forward. Phase 1 of the bypass includes a brand new roadway that will extend for about 4 miles between Oregon 219 in Newburg and Oregon 99W just south of Dundee, and will include one lane in each direction and new signalized intersections at both ends. As you can imagine, this is a large and complicated project. In Dundee, the bypass will connect to Oregon 99W. A large bridge will be built that crosses over the railroad and highway at this location. Let's show you what has been accomplished so far. Here, you can see the areas that have already been cleared for the roadway. At the Dundee end, 500,000 lineal feet of wick drains were installed to draw water from underground, and heavy gravel has been added to speed up natural settling to ensure bridges are built on compact ground. The first bridge for the project will be complete by spring of 2014. In January, 755-foot-long beams were hauled into Dundee. Crews used two large cranes to set the 7 beams in place, one by one, over 2 days. 10 bridges will be built as part of Phase 1. This first bridge is approximately 200 feet long and crosses over a small creek. Traveling east towards Newburg, we cross many acres of property that ODOT has purchased for the bypass. In Newburg, the bypass will skirt the southern edge of town on a 2,200-foot-long bridge crossing over the railroad tracks and College and River Streets. The bypass will be tucked between 11th Street and the paper mill. Looking toward where the bypass will connect to Oregon 219, neighbors have seen a lot of change. The area between Winooski and Oregon 219 has been excavated down to allow for the flight path for the neighboring airfield. A few large stormwater ponds, some up to 35 feet deep, have also been excavated. Runoff from the roadway will be directed to the ponds for filtration that will prevent harmful pollution from getting into our streams and creeks. A small tributary of Hess Creek has been placed into a new 300-foot-long culvert. Great care has been taken to protect fish during the reconfiguration of their habitat. There is much work left to do before Phase 1 is complete. We appreciate the patience of neighbors and the traveling public as work continues. For more information on construction of the first phase of the bypass, or planning for the full bypass, please visit our website at newburgdundee.org.
So moving on to the Woodburn Interchange, another major project for us that we've been working on through the winter. K&E Contractors out of Salem is the contractor, and they've been actually making great progress. And we're optimistic we could save several months, if not a year, off the time of this particular project. Here's a shot kind of showing the development of the loop ramps in each of the quadrants taking shape as you drive by. You can start to see how those will function. Another shot of those developments.
When did you say is the current expected completion date?
Our schedule is showing 2016, but we're optimistic it might be as early as late 15 that we might be able to see. But I think essentially you'll see construction this summer and next summer. It depends on how much will trickle into the next summer will be our question. So next week, if you happen to be driving up I-5 about 2 o'clock in the morning, you'll see I-5 will be closed, and we'll have cranes in here setting up the new beams across for that bridge, and we'll be routing traffic on the on and off ramps to get around. But if you're driving in the morning, you'll see them kind of magically appear overnight.
Is that Representative Cameron? That's your new district, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, no, and I drive it at 2 o'clock in the morning quite often.
Yeah, quite often.
Actually, Sonny came in and gave me this update yesterday.
So. Yeah. All right. All right. Good.
So one of the things we have on this project is a live camera. So if you're interested in watching the progress, here's a shot that's on the east side of the interchange looking west. I was watching this earlier today. They actually had work within the camera. It looks like they've just moved outside of the camera range there.
This is at least as interesting as the Tualatin Valley Cable. Right, Representative Dory? The public access stuff.
Pioneer Mountain Eddyville is another project I've talked to you about before, one we've struggled with over the last several years. However, our confidence with this project continues to grow as we move forward with our design, our instrumentation, and we have different packages each year go out to bid. Last year's work was very successful. K&E Contractors out of Salem was the contractor. Their bid was less than what our budget was, and we were actually able to move some work forward into that contract to accelerate some of the work. That helped us in this year's bidding. The project came in significantly under what our budget was for the work that we have scheduled for the next 2 years, and that work will begin in the next few weeks. But again, our confidence grows as we continue to understand more about the geology of the area and fine-tune our design with the project. So here's another short just video.
Since 2012, when ODOT took control of the design and delivery of the U.S. 20 project in Lincoln County, three new phases of construction have been completed on time and within the estimated budget. The construction and placement of more than 3,200 feet of culvert to replace four bridges was among the construction completed in 2013. In addition, 90 miles of horizontal drains have now been constructed, reducing subsurface water pressures that cause landslide activity. Installation of more than 300 ground monitoring instruments has been completed, allowing ODOT to gather precise ground movement data. By taking an observational approach, ODOT is now able to accurately pinpoint where and what additional slide mitigation is needed. Two more phases of construction will take place in 2014 and 2015. One will move 2.5 million yards of earth and rock, forming the unfinished roadbed. It will focus on slide mitigation by installing 20 more miles of horizontal drains, constructing 415 ground acres, and constructing large rock buttresses with some of the 600,000 tons of rock created during earlier phases. The second phase will improve habitat for fish and wildlife, adding to the expected total of 20 mitigation sites when the project is completed. With a total estimated price tag of $365.78 million, the 5.5 miles of the new U.S. 20, bypassing 10 miles of the old highway, already includes 8 completed bridges and half the roadway constructed and paved. When complete, it will offer a straighter and more efficient connection between the valley and the coast, with wide shoulders, more passing opportunities, and allowing for modern freight travel. Traffic on the new highway remains scheduled for 2016.
As you've made that change, we've had this conversation before too, but are there additional lessons you've learned that are going to be applied in future projects?
Chair Reed, I think the obvious lessons of how to use design build and how to contract, I think one of the things that we're getting a growing appreciation for the last few months or years as we've taken over this project is really a project with this many risks and this many unknowns of stepping into it with relatively short and smaller contracts rather than try to design the complete contract from the very beginning and go out with one contract and then deal with contract change orders and risks, so forth. But managing that risk on those smaller contracts kind of one at a time, which also allows those local contractors to be more competitive in the bidding process. Mm-hmm. So I think that general approach is one on projects like this with an amount of risk. I think we have a greater appreciation of where we would use those in the future on projects like this.
Good. Thanks.
Beltline project in Eugene, another one I've talked about, another significant project. We've completed units 1 and 2, and so we've been working on unit 3. This project continues to move along nicely. Again, K&E Contractors out of Salem is the contractor on this. On this project, we've actually taken a loop ramp out in this quadrant to improve the merges or weaves on the highway, and we're working currently on the bridge on Beltline over I-5 and making making modifications to the ramps here in the northwest quadrant of the interchange. Here's a view of some of the bridge work that's going on. Unit 4 is also funded with JTA and is scheduled to follow. We're having some discussions with the community about whether we need every piece of that Unit 4 or not, or whether we could utilize those funds maybe elsewhere on Beltline or other projects. So those projects or conversations are ongoing, and obviously we'd be back to you to make any changes in the JTA project. So Sisters, Oregon, many of you, have been through Sisters. If you've went through there this spring, this is what it looked like. This is actually a picture that I took on my tour over there about a month ago as I visited some of the business owners along Highway 20 and Sisters. We've had downtown Sisters closed for about 2 months completely, and detouring traffic on the streets around. The contractor has been working very aggressively to basically rebuild the entire roadway section in Sisters. We started conversations with the city several years ago and came to them and said, you know, we've got to repave downtown Sisters. The pavements have worn out, and we've got to do a total rebuild of the project. And we've worked with them to time the project. In this case, we started work essentially as soon as the snow stopped and made a commitment to them that we'd have the highway back open again before Memorial Day, which we did. In fact, here's the director last Friday at a ribbon cutting in downtown Sisters. But the other kind of piece from this project is we were able to use the paving project that we had, use it as an opportunity to leverage additional grant opportunities and funding opportunities, where we had 6 or 7 different funding sources that's going to totally revitalize downtown Sisters, clear from the awnings off the storefronts to the sidewalks to the planter strips, and it's going to be something the community is going to be very proud of. As I toured the area and talked to business owners, obviously their business was revenue was devastated over the last couple of months, but they're all very optimistic and very appreciative of the project and appreciative of our communication and very complimentary of the contractor and how they've gone out of their way to help accommodate both the visitors to their customers to the businesses as well as speed the construction along.
What were some of the other funding sources that you mentioned?
There was some local funding that the city actually came up with city money and said we'd match dollar for dollar businesses that were willing to do their awnings and try to encourage them to replace all the awnings across the through the city. We had some forest highway enhanced funds. We had other local funding. I can't name them all, but there was
primarily local.
5 or 6. Yeah, and okay. There were some federal, there were some local, there were some state. It was really a combination of many different ones that we really partnered with the city and went out with this vision we had for the community and went after the other funding to kind of complement our paving project. I got a short video here, too. We'll see.
It was bright and early Monday morning as crews set to work in Sisters, preparing to take out the old highway and put in the new. They've got a tight deadline to get in, remove the old, crumbling highway surface, take out the sidewalks, rebuild the drainage, and put it all back together again. ODOT's been working with the city of Sisters for over 5 years to get to this date, knowing that there was no other option but to completely rebuild the highway. There's been so much traffic through Sisters that the highway was simply falling apart from use. What we've promised to do is have the heavy highway building done before the end of May and the start of the busy tourism season. That means the workers will be there, day and night when necessary, to get the job done. The job is worth $5 million or so when all is taken into account, and it will rebuild 6 blocks of the downtown highway along Cascade, right through the middle of town. But we'll do it in stages and keep access to downtown open for business. When it's done, what a difference it'll make. Smooth streets, wide pedestrian-friendly sidewalks, benches, trees, lamps, a whole new streetscape for the community. And just like all the folks and Sisters, we can't wait for the job to be done and see how it looks. Now please bear with us as we take care of the highway and the people who use it.
So I think it's a project that obviously they're going to be very proud of, and I think it'll make other communities, frankly, kind of jealous.
Great. Representative Lively?
And I'd just like to compliment. I travel back and forth with a lot because we have a place in Central Oregon and spent a lot of time in Sisters, and we were there when they first closed the highway at night. We got there and they closed it. But it was phenomenal how quickly the project went forward, and I know I've read about some of the problems they encountered about buildings being on the sidewalk and stuff that they didn't plan on, and the people responded very well. But in talking to businesses, while they were frustrated somewhat, they're very excited about the opportunity and are pleased, I know from what we've heard, that it is going to really change Sisters. So I think everybody's to be complimented on that project.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we don't see in that picture is the visual clutter from cables, power and phone and so forth, going down the street. At some point, they've been moved underground or they're parallel in an alley or something. You do see a few places where cables are going across the highway overhead, but you don't see the clutter of pole after pole after pole of hanging the cables. One of the things I'm very interested in and have encouraged, sponsored, caused to happen a couple of projects in my own community is the undergrounding of utilities. It's a safety issue as well as of course, the appearance is more attractive, but there is safety and efficiency and cost savings over time when you move utilities underground. Is that ever included as part of your projects in smaller communities?
Representative Nathanson, yes, oftentimes we'll include that work and coordinate with utilities to help. We'll pay for the undergrounding of them, but we'll coordinate those with our projects. You remember, Representative Parrish, we had some discussion back in February about fiber and internet usage and how we'd coordinate that. We've been continuing to have those conversations, but it's a broader conversation with all utilities of making sure they're aware when we're going to have projects, when we do have opportunities like this, and how they can budget ahead of time in their capital planning along with ours so we can coordinate our projects in a way that we get those kind of outcomes that are beneficial to the community.
And the private sector also, which is sometimes, not as often as we hope, but sometimes looking to expand broadband access to further reach in throughout Oregon. Are we communicating with private cable companies and fiber optic providers?
Representative Nathanson, yes, we are. We've reached out to them, and we're sharing our program with them and finding ways to coordinate our projects with their needs.
Thank you.
Staying in Bend or in the Central Oregon area in the south end of Bend, we have the Murphy Road Project, which is where the Bend Parkway comes back into Highway 97 on the south side. This project takes out that traffic signal that's there, provides an overpass, but also provides a much-needed east-west connection within the community of Bend on Murphy Road. Here's a picture of setting the beams. That will be the bridge that replaces the traffic signal that's there on 97. And then here's the structure that will provide the Murphy Road connection, that east-west connection for the city. This is the first of two phases for this project, and it's also moving along nicely. Hamilton Construction is the contractor. In Southern Oregon, Fern Valley Interchange is just south of the Medford area. It's a project we've been working on a number of years with the community to kind of fine-tune the design and find something that will fit in the community. We ended up with a very innovative design. This is a design that is not seen anywhere on the West Coast, but is becoming more and more popular across the country. It's called the Diverging Diamond. You actually drive at some point on the other side of the road than you normally would, and you cross over. As I have maybe time in a future presentation, I can give you a demonstration of how that's going to work. But this project just kicked off this spring, and we finished up next fall. Here's some of the early pictures as they begin to do some of the work on that interchange. One last thing I want to leave with is May is Work Zone Safety Month. It's a new focus for us from the director to focus on work zone safety. We lose thousands of lives across the country in work zones every year. Fortunately, in Oregon, we've seen a slight downturn in those, but nationally, we see an increase in deaths and major injuries in work zones. In fact, four out of the five fatalities that happen in work zones are actual passengers or drivers of vehicles and not the workers. The worker exposure in work zones is very high. Seven times the national average is the exposure that they have to serious or fatal consequences in their work zone. So we've gone to work on some things to reduce speeds in our work zones and to increase some more positive protection between the workers and the traveling public. One of the areas that we're focused on is night paving to deal with a lot of the traffic concerns. We focus our paving to happen at night, but obviously there's some safety concerns, impaired drivers, speed, other issues that we see for those people in the paving equipment working sometimes very few feet away from moving traffic. One last thing, if we just have a few minutes, I have just a short video here that I want to show you around work zones and just how dangerous work zones can be. This is a video that we produced internally in ODOT. It shows one of our maintenance work zones. Those of you familiar with I-5 and the Siskiyou Summit on the California border, we had a situation where a runaway truck lost its brakes coming down that hill and went right through the center of one of our paving operations. We had an entire crew with a lane closed out there paving the roadway, and they had a truck going 70 to 75 miles an hour through that work zone. And so we reenacted this, and we've shared this with our crews around the state, and I thought it'd be worth showing here today of just kind of how dangerous it is to be out there on the road.
Working on Oregon's roads can be a dangerous job. Think about your safety each and every day. I know I do.
You know, we figure he was probably doing between 70 to 75 miles an hour when he came through the work zone because he had no brakes. I just about lost my whole entire crew that day.
I was actually the hallway truck for the grinder, and we just made the last pass with the grinder, so I pulled up against the barrier, and I was facing uphill, and I was standing on the barrier, and some equipment below me was repositioning the grader and the loader, and I look up the hill at traffic coming down, and I see a truck smoking pretty bad. I thought it was on fire.
We were standing right out there in the middle of that flow lane, right at this location when the truck came through.
Here comes a 80,000 pound, 53 foot truck trailer combination out of control coming off the summit. His brakes were just smoking. And he goes by and it was the smoke was amazing. Then it was all over, and we were looking around and just trying to figure out what had just happened actually.
There's close calls, but when they're so close that you feel them, and that's what that was. I mean, you could feel the air off the truck, and he was by before you could really even think about what was going on.
First, he was taking out the cones as he was coming down through here, and in the summertime, these cones, they get warm, they get very flexible, but the speed that he hit these at, he was snapping them. So cones were just flying in pieces as he came down through here. We didn't jump. Everybody dove over the barrier. It was just to get to a safe zone as quick as possible.
We always know our escape routes. We spot each other. We take, you know, when we're doing lane closures or whatever we're doing, we have our signs, our cones, you know. We try to protect ourselves. But, you know, a cone's a cone.
The only thing separating you from traffic doing 65 miles an hour is a 3-foot cone. That's a lot to take seriously.
Keep your head in the game. You know, always be aware of your surroundings and your escape routes, and look at your more experienced people and kind of stay close to them so you can see, you know, what they've learned over the years and what you can do to protect yourself out there.
After the incident, once we did an accident or a near-miss accident investigation, we went through the process that we went through that day, and our work zone was set up correctly. We had spotters in the right places. We had done everything correctly that day.
We have families to go home to. I got two kids I want to go home to every night, and people drive like that, and chances go down to me going home every night.
You never know what you're going to face each and every day. Be ready. Be prepared. And expect the unexpected. After all, it can be a dangerous job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I would assume everyone was safe. What happened to the truck?
Everyone was fine. Somehow, miraculously, that they were able to, you know, as they said, jump over the barrier and get out of the way. The truck actually ended up going down and collided with another truck. It wasn't a severe accident, but ended up making it clear to the bottom of the hill before it was able to completely stop and get off of the shoulder.
Very scary and a good reminder. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for that. Okay, we will move on. As befitting our the name of our committee, we're going to take a temporary detour from the transportation side of our business and go over to economic development. We'll come back to transportation in a bit, and we want to get a, an update on some of our small business startup assistance activity, and particularly around RAIN. So invite Shula Jaron. Hopefully I got that somewhat close. Justin Freeman and Joe Marishak. Great. Thanks. I imagine you've coordinated and choreographed your presentation, so please go ahead.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jim Marushak from Eugene, here representing RAIN, the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network. RAIN is a unique public-private partnership between the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, cities Eugene, Springfield, Corvallis, and Albany. Two regional accelerators work with local entrepreneurial communities to create seamless innovation ecosystems for the Southern Willamette Valley. The goal of RAIN is ultimately to create jobs and improve the economy in our region. People think about RAIN, their thoughts usually jump to what is the most visible and tangible part of RAIN, which is the regional accelerators, the RA in RAIN. I was brought on to set up and run the Eugene node of the accelerator program. Progress on getting the accelerator open in Eugene is going well, and excitement and community engagement for the initiative is high. I'm not going to talk about the accelerator today. I'm going to take this opportunity to focus on the other less tangible part of RAIN, the innovation network, the IN in RAIN. Innovation Network is presently more a concept than a program. It is, at its very core, about connectivity. It's about leveraging the resource we have, utilizing the people we know and work with in government, the private sector, and academia to figure out new ways of working together. The Innovation Network is about our community. It's about working together across all organizations to help create, grow, and keep companies in our communities. In Eugene, we are not looking to replace the infrastructure we have. We are looking to connect and support what already exists. We are looking to help community partners, like the Fertilab Incubator, find the funding they need to fulfill their mission. This is not a small job. On one side of the spectrum, we have everything from entrepreneurial education in the community to STEM education through K-12. On the other side of the spectrum, we have the not insignificant challenges of capital formation and creating infrastructure between Corvallis and Eugene nodes of our accelerator programs. Add to this the ongoing work that we will need to do with the communities to ensure the companies we work with can find a home here locally. We will need to work to ensure the startups have access to the resources they need to grow and thrive. The task ahead of us is huge. We'd certainly use more resources, both human and financial, primarily on the education side. Education will be the key to the transformation we're looking for. Creating connectivity and finding ways to deepen and strengthen our network is where we'll need to focus our efforts. RAIN is just getting started, but I've already been witness to some early signs of success. And I'm going to tell a story. The story is a very powerful indicator of the potential of RAIN to transform lives and transform our regional economy. Here's my story. A few months ago, a friend of mine, David Bong, who's the CEO of Avant Assessment in Eugene, Oregon, introduced me to a friend of his, Britt Jefferson. Britt is a VP at Wells Fargo in Eugene, and interested in entrepreneurship in our community. Wanted to see what he could do to help. After I got my appointment to RAIN, which was last month, Britt called, and congratulations. During our talk, he asked if I knew Mary Phillips, who's the director of transfer at OSU. I did not. He introduced us. Mary and I chatted a bit, and we agreed to meet up for coffee next time I was in Corvallis, so we could see how we might be able to work together. This week, Mary contacted me via email and asked me for some advice. She asked the same advice of Mark Lieberman, the chief startup officer of the Advantage Accelerator in Corvallis. He suggested that she contact me. Mary told me a story of three Latino women in Monroe. These women were working with the College of Engineering Corvallis to develop a machine for food product they are developing. These women are not native English speakers or readers, and they had trouble educating themselves using online materials. Mary asked me if I knew a way I could help them. My mind immediately jumped to Lisa Hartwick at NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation in Springfield, Oregon. Specializes in food through their Sprout Incubator and has programs specifically geared toward traditionally underserved communities. I made the introduction. This was 4 days ago. This is the Innovation Network in action. Our effort to network our communities is already paying off in ways that I could not have anticipated. Our efforts to connect in order to facilitate high-tech companies is creating positive impact in all parts of our entrepreneurial ecosystem. This is a small story. One small example is an indicator that we can expect of what we can expect of the impact we can create in the lives of our citizens and the health of our communities. I want to thank you for supporting RAIN and hope that you'll see the benefit of continuing to support our efforts in the future. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from the other two and then we'll have questions.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Shula Jaron. I live in Eugene, and I'm one of the co-founders and now a co-director of the Fertilabs Incubator. Today, I would like to tell you about what and who the Fertilab is. But first, let me tell you a little bit about my own story. I came to Eugene for a job at a company at the time called Invitrogen. Now, you may have heard of them as Invitrogen or Life Technologies, or now they're called Thermo Fisher Scientific. However, the place got its start as Molecular Probes, started by two entrepreneurs out of their garage. They brought the company to Eugene in 1983 as a startup with just the two of them. Over the years, they built their company in Eugene to a few hundred employees and sold it to Invitrogen in 2004 for hundreds of millions of dollars. They drew many of their employees from the local area. And what I experienced when I arrived in the mid-2000s was a company that employed many well-paid professionals in the Eugene area, people who had chosen to come to Eugene, not Boston or the Bay Area, for their careers. There's no doubt that businesses that grow and are successful positively impact the local economy by creating jobs and bringing in money. But even more important is that these companies also grow new entrepreneurs, which get spun out and seed the area with other smaller startups, creating hubs of innovation. Eugene has strong hubs in a few areas, including biotech, food, and education. And we need to make sure we support and grow the good startups in these hubs. I am one of those entrepreneurs that spun out from a local successful business in biotech, and my goal is to build a sustainable business in the Eugene area. When I began my leap toward becoming an entrepreneur over a year ago, I realized a few things. Resources were available, but it was not always clear how to find them or even what exactly I needed. The best resources I had were actually the other entrepreneurs I started meeting who were close to my own situation. Unfortunately, there wasn't any place or group to find those people easily. This led me and my three other co-founders to start Fertilab Thinkubator, a startup incubator and collaborative community in Eugene, Oregon. So what is Fertilab? I have a short video that gives a small flavor of what we do.
I'm Justin Freeman, and I'm one of the directors here at the Fertilab Thinkubator. The Fertilab Thinkubator is a nonprofit business incubator and co-working space located in downtown Eugene. We exist to serve and empower the entrepreneurs in Lane County. And so as part of that, we decided to host the first ever Fertilab Pitch Weekend competition. We had 15 different companies come in and pitch their business ideas in front of their friends, in front of a bunch of fellow entrepreneurs, and a panel of judges. You know, our facilities are great. We're in this kind of funky old building. It's a 100-year-old building in Eugene. And we have access to great lab equipment. But what's really great about Fertilab is the community. Kind of an iron sharpening iron thing. We really try and help one another out. We recognize that a rising tide lifts all boats and that it's very beneficial for all of us if one of us succeeds.
So what is FreeLab? Well, we are a physical space as well as a vibrant entrepreneurial community in Eugene, Oregon. We have wet lab space and co-working space, desks, and conference rooms. Our ability to support biotech startups is a unique feature of our space, but what sets us apart is our collaborative and cooperative community. Here are three of our lab companies, all midstream in product development. Two of these, NemaMetrics and SuperSensor, are actually U of O spin-offs. But I want to spend just a second on BT Biotech. They actually began at an event that was hosted by FertiLab. They are not affiliated with the U of O, and they have developed most of their key connections to advisors and mentors and service providers by being active participants in our community. And they have raised more than $100,000 in angel funding for their business based on being part of our community. Outside of the lab, we support a vibrant community of entrepreneurs by offering a location for the community to exist and encouraging and supporting near-peer mentoring. I'd like to leave you with FertiLab by the numbers. We have 10 companies that run the gamut of game development, market research, biotech, and software. Two of these are funded by Phase 1 SBIRs, two angel funding. We have 30 paying members, and our events have drawn in more hundreds of local entrepreneurs, many of which who are repeat customers. Our events are open and free to anyone in the local community, and what we have seen is that people come into FertiLab to build their company, and advisors, mentors, and funders are able to come in to network with a bunch of entrepreneurs at one time and in one place. Just this morning, we had 30 people come in for just that type of networking. And although we are part of the RAIN Innovation Network, and we believe in RAIN, and we believe it is a great start to supporting high-growth startups in the Valley, we are currently completely bootstrapped by our four founders and operating as a nonprofit. We are greatly interested in the economic development in the Valley, and we believe FertiLab is well-poised to have a big impact on growth in the area. Thank you again for the opportunity to visit with you today, and I'm happy to take questions at the end.
Thank you very much. Mr. Freeman, anything to add?
Sure thing. Chairman Reed, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and testify today. My name is Justin Freeman, and along with Sheila, I'm one of the co-directors at the FertiLab Incubator. Last year, the Kauffman Foundation identified the 25 metro areas that had the greatest high-tech startup density in America as of 2010, which was the latest data they could get. And so basically what that means is they identified the 25 metro areas that were more likely to have high-tech startups as compared to America on average. Not surprisingly, Boulder, Colorado was on top of the list. They produced startups there at six times the national rate. You know, and Boulder's well known as a hub of technology and innovation, so this really isn't a shock. But what's really interesting is that four of the other most productive startup cities are within 100 miles of Boulder. Colorado Springs, Denver, Fort Collins, and Cheyenne, Wyoming are all among the top 10. So this is a regional, trans-state, entrepreneurial, investment, and economic development success story. And our goal at FertiLab is to really contribute to a similar outcome here in Oregon. If you look back at the Kauffman list, Seattle rated fourth on the list, which gives substantial credibility regionally to our efforts. And Oregon did really well as well, with Corvallis, Bend, and Portland all rating in the top 25 metro areas for startup density. I'm actually a recent transplant to Oregon. I relocated here last October from Boulder. We came here, my wife is a physician, and she joined a private practice in Eugene, which motivated our move, that and the fishing, which is wonderful. I have a background in technology and science, and I've worked in both the private sector and in academic research. When we moved to the area, I became aware of FertiLab, and as I shared the organization's focus on helping people grow science and technology-based businesses, I joined the community. At the time, I worked full-time for a remote employer back in Colorado and thought that basing my office out of Fertilab would afford me some benefit just being in that community. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to gain from working out of the Fertilab space, but I knew that I wanted to work around a group of people who all shared a common interest in high-tech startups. And so in these last few months, here's what I've experienced. One thing that Fertilab does is they help convert the potential entrepreneur into an actual entrepreneur and get people off the sidelines. So what happens there is the community provides the activation energy needed to get somebody started in a high-tech startup. And we do this by providing incredibly affordable space, access to great equipment, and most importantly, amazing mentoring and peer relationships. In my case, I benefited from this. I actually became an Oregon-based entrepreneur by joining up with another Fertilab member who I met there, and I'm now a co-founder in his software startup. Now, this has happened several times, as Shulin mentioned, with BT Biotech. We've had several businesses that have formed out of kind of the primordial ooze of entrepreneurship, if you will, that we cultivate at Fertilab. Beyond that, we help entrepreneurs increase their likelihood of success. Most startups fail. We want to make it so that startups that are part of Fertilab are more likely to succeed. And the needs of a software or a biotech startup are unique, and they're different from those of a more traditional Main Street small business. It's not that they're any better or any worse. They're just focused on solving a few different problems. So, for instance, our entrepreneurs are working to solve problems and provide products and services that will be sold around the country and worldwide. Their competitors, rather than being local competitors, generally are the software and biotech companies of Silicon Valley and other technology hubs. Knowledge-based entrepreneurs also get their funding from slightly different sources than your traditional local entrepreneur. They tend to get funding from angel investors, technology accelerators, and occasionally, if they're doing really well, venture capitalists. And so operating in these big markets, competitive spaces, and funding arenas, it's not easy. And there are very few resources that exist to help serve those types of entrepreneurs. But the Fertilab community is intentionally built to help educate and prepare startup entrepreneurs to engage in these environments. Personally, I've experienced this at Fertilab through the mentoring I've received from successful startup entrepreneurs, the introductions I've had and helped make to influential technologists and investors, and the startup-specific educational program that we have in the community. Fertilab is bringing together the entrepreneurial community in and around Eugene and Springfield. I'm glad to be a part of it. In just a few short months that I've been there, I've seen amazing growth and development spring from our efforts. Eugene is poised for an entrepreneurial boom, one that will position the community in a sustainable growth phase for the foreseeable future. It reminds me of Boulder 10 years ago, and that's not to say that Eugene is behind the times in any way. Rather, I see the raw components needed there to support long-term entrepreneurial growth. We have a top-tier research university in town, a small but growing track record of successful technology business launches, and an unbeatable quality of life. We're just now entering the second year of what's probably going to be a 5, maybe 10-year process of building a thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem in the Southern Willamette Valley. Fertilab has helped that effort. A year ago, there wasn't much for the unified startup community to speak of in the area. Now we have dozens of PhDs, engineers, MBAs, scientists, marketers, product developers, financiers, students, and other allied professionals who are connecting with one another, starting companies, and promoting entrepreneurship as a means for economic development and long-term sustainability in Eugene, Oregon, and the Pacific Northwest. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and at this point, I think we'll take your questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the group? I'm particularly interested, Joe, maybe you could explain a little bit more about the RAIN. I appreciated your introduction about Fertilab being part of the IN, but if you could kind of enlighten us and remind us that the state and the legislature made an investment in RAIN, could you give us a little bit more of a refresher on the overall structure? And I'm taking from this presentation that Fertilab is in, maybe for lack of a better word, an affiliate, a part of the network, but if you could give us a little more overall structure.
Fertilab is an affiliate of RAIN. We're still working sort of the affiliate program, what that looks like. RAIN itself is actually two accelerators. There's one in Corvallis, there's one in Eugene. Corvallis Accelerator opened immediately after the approval of the legislation last year. They had that in the works for some time. So immediately after that got approved, they opened up the Corvallis Accelerator, and they'd been funding that through OSU for the past year. The Eugene Accelerator actually got up and running when I got hired in April. So,
and that's separate from Fertilab, though?
It's separate from Fertilab,
okay.
Yes.
So given that, maybe a question for all three of you, can you talk about what you sort of view as the appropriate kind of mix of incubators and co-working spaces? At some point, you're probably going to run up against some capacity, whether it's physical or something else, and how do you see all of your sort of colleagues in this space interacting in Eugene and across the state?
So the accelerator fulfills a different purpose than the incubators. Mm-hmm. The way we see it is an incubator is for incubating early stage companies.
Of course.
So we have people coming in and at a very early stage don't have much education. They're actually working on earlier stage research often. The accelerator itself, once people are ready to get accelerated, come into the accelerator and we'll launch them into the business world. So the accelerator is maybe you'll spend a year in an incubator or a year at a co-working space working on your idea. When your idea is fully formed, put it through the accelerator, accelerate you. After you go through the accelerator, money will attach, and ideally, you'll land in the community.
But in terms of if you all at Fertilab run up against the capacity, where is that? Do you expect you'd want to open a second space? Are there others that are doing similar things to you in Eugene? How do you interact with each other and so on?
Chairman Reed. So currently we're a community of anybody who's an entrepreneur in Eugene, and we kind of like it that way because it means that people that are coming from different backgrounds and maybe having different ideas of where they're going to to go in the future are interacting with each other. But you know, long term, it's quite likely that it makes sense to have incubators that are specific for a certain hub. So a food incubator, a beer and wine incubator, a biotech incubator, which at this point we're sort of holding down the fort on the biotech incubator side. We also are looking at, we have a second location that's opening that's called Fertilab Shop, and so that's all around building hardware, essentially. So they have all of the things that you might find in a very souped-up garage, so that people can build things. And then we also are looking at partnering with the U of O to open a second biotech co-working space there.
So as part of RAIN, I convene meetings between all the co-working spaces in town, all the co-working spaces and incubation spaces, so we can communicate what we're doing. Okay. And what we try to do is when someone's coming into the community, we try to route them to the appropriate place. Okay. Much as when someone came to me looking for advice on food, I can't accelerate in my accelerator, but that's what Sprout is built for. So we actually direct them to the right place, and we communicate openly how to do that.
Okay. Okay. Questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things I wanted to ask about. You mentioned access to equipment. You said you're sort of holding down the fort on biotech. There could be food. There could be, well, you're also doing game and other software stuff. Give us an example of the kind of equipment that someone had to buy and install in the Fertilab incubator that makes it possible for people to do their research or do their early experiments in product feasibility. What did you buy? What did you install that makes this place attractive to someone?
Well, we have a number of pieces of equipment, and we've been very fortunate to have most of our equipment donated to us. Almost all of the equipment that we've had donated has been stuff that would be specific to biotech startups. For example, we have some very nice shaker incubators, so if you want to grow cells. We have hoods, chemistry hoods. We have, and one piece of equipment actually that comes to mind immediately is we were very fortunate to get an HPLC that also does some mass spec. And that is a very expensive piece of equipment that a local company had completely depreciated and they didn't need anymore. So they were able to give it to us, and we are in the process of getting it up and running. But that piece of equipment will mean we have an entrepreneur who needs that piece of equipment to do his work. And without that piece of equipment, he would not be able to start his business because it's far outside of what the price range of what he'd be able to afford.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes, please.
So that leads me to expanding the issue. What you're doing with RAIN and with Fertilab is you are providing, we are investing in providing the infrastructure for startup businesses rather than providing money to individual persons or individual businesses. In this committee, we often hear about the need to untangle bureaucracy, the need to streamline regulations, the need to change tax codes and so forth. But even beyond all that, it seems like there is something fairly significant that we should be aware of and be prepared to support, which is the infrastructure for helping business. Just like we need to provide highway, rail, marine, and air transport to get products to market and move people. That's a type of infrastructure. It sounds like what you're talking about, the networking, the connecting people, the connecting ideas, pointing them to the right, let's say, product attorneys or corporate attorneys for startups or providing the right equipment. There's something about just this basic infrastructure to help people figure out how to get started. What, in your perspective, what's Oregon's investment in helping that aspect of infrastructure? How much do we do? How much is appropriate?
A lot more than we're presently doing. and part of the challenge is that we don't have anyone that's overseeing the big picture. So we have companies that are launching right now. They're two people, maybe they're four people. And I'll use them like a Probe's example. They decided to stay in Eugene. They could have easily at any point in their growth decided to just leave because it was too hard. Right now they're two people, then they're 10 people. And in my personal example, we were two people, then we were five people, then we were 10 people, then we were 40 people, then we were 140 people within a year. And when we were at 140 people, it was very, very difficult for us to grow. We weren't interacting with the community. We weren't interacting with the city. We grew, sold our company, and then most of it left Eugene, unfortunately, when it collapsed, without the city even knowing who we were, for the most part. We need to actually bring to the attention of everyone in the city and everyone in government what's going on to create that pipeline. So if you have a two-person company that looks like it's going to be a five-person company, right now they're nothing. Suddenly, if they have a 30-person company, they're a 30-person company that might be on the cusp of becoming a 100-person company that might become a major economic driver. And we need someone overseeing that. It's not very expensive. There needs to be one person that's interfacing with all the companies and keeping tabs and really looking down the road a couple years. What do we need to build in order to keep these companies in our communities? For education, do we actually have to look at our education? We're competing for knowledge workers with Palo Alto, with Boulder, with Boston. When they come and look at our schools, they need to be convinced that the schools have parity. When we're looking at all these infrastructure issues, transportation issues, issues of flights coming in and out of Eugene, we have to look at those issues because we're in competition for other places that have cheaper flights to places where people do business.
Appreciate the comment. I think there are efforts. I guess I would share your comment about them not being adequate in the current effort, but I would say there are places where they're connecting. So Fertilab, I'm guessing from what you said, has some sort of a membership fee, or how does that work?
No, we currently have a membership fee, and so the membership plus the very shallow pockets of our co-founders are funding it.
Okay. So, Joe, what would you suggest that this committee and other legislators anticipate from RAIN in the upcoming session in terms of policy or budgetary requests? What should we be looking for from that?
When it gets fully formed, I think you'll see a lot of requests all across the spectrum. What we have is we can't just focus on any one part of the system. We can't just focus on capital, because having only capital is not going to affect workforce development for the companies to grow. Focusing on workforce development doesn't address the capital issues. Focusing solely on education is just going to give us educated people. It's not going to give us access to everything. So what I think you're going to see is a lot of proposals across the spectrum. We need little pieces of infrastructure all over the place. We need little pieces to help organize capital formation. I think the capital will come from private sources, but we need some infrastructure to help organize it. I think that we're going to have to do some workforce development and education. Really, what does the workforce need to be to switch to knowledge-based economy in software or in biotech? And these sorts of things, all these little buckets, will come across as like a little package of, say, 40 different individual small items that will help connect it all together.
Appreciate that. I would encourage you to, as that those proposals get developed, keep looking to the other entities that exist to help organize that and connect across the legislature as well. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. We look forward to hearing more about what you're up to. We'll head back to the transportation side of our agenda. Invite Craig Campbell up, and anyone you'd like to bring with you while he's getting settled. It's worth reminding the committee that of Craig's role as president of the Oregon Transportation Forum. Ms. Ford gave us a little bit of a preview earlier about the governor's long-run vision for transportation. Craig and his colleagues with the Transportation Forum have been commencing some of the work that we hope will lead to a big transportation discussion in 2015, so we thought it would be appropriate to get an update. Craig, thanks for being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here, as the chair just said, as president of the Oregon Transportation Forum, and with me are the chairs of the four breakout subgroups that the forum has been has organized, as it is starting to do work in bringing folks together for a discussion about what and whether a transportation funding and policy package is going to occur in 2015. I'll give you a little background on the Oregon Transportation Forum itself. It was originally formed, I think, back in the late 50s as the Oregon Highway Users Alliance, and existed in that form until about 3 years ago. At that point in time, those of us who were involved in the Highway Users Alliance realized that the discussion around the transportation system needed to be just that, not about highways alone, but how we dealt with all of our transportation needs in the state, how we integrate those needs and those modes so that we were having kind of a one-package discussion rather than having a series of siloed discussions about how we try and take care of disparate parts of a system and not talking about how we connect them. Currently, the Oregon Transportation Forum has 37 member organizations, which include business associations, local government, environmental groups, land use groups. Every mode is represented in our organization. And one of the tasks that we have taken on, as the legislature was struggling with the Columbia River crossing, we realized that there was not a place where there was a discussion about what to do in 2015 around transportation in a larger sense about funding and about policy. And so we basically started a discussion amongst the groups that were members of the Oregon Transportation Forum, and we opened it up so even if you aren't a member, we welcome you to the table. The idea there was you bring everyone around the table at the same time. You have an open dialogue about what we want to do to go forward. Certainly, you're going to get a lot of ideas. Some of them have been tried before. Some of them may be those aha moments that you want to grasp onto and use as you proceed forward. And so we've been having those meetings starting last January. We're averaging about 50 attendees at each of our meetings, not to mention some of the legislators, many of whom are sitting in front of us today. So I want to thank Representative McEwen, Representative Lively, Chair Reed, and Representative Parrish, who have been at, I think, all of our main meetings. So thank you very much for that. I wanted to say a special thank you to Patrick, who's also been at all of our meetings, and I think all of our subgroup meetings as well. And we found out, quite to his chagrin, that he takes excellent notes. The Transportation Forum is not a very robust financial organization, and we have one person who helps us out staff-wise, and there's no way we could ask her to take on all of those responsibilities, so we take any free assistance we can get. The the four subgroups that have been organized are organized around some fairly discrete purposes. We had a broader focus before the governor had announced that he wanted to do a visioning process, and as a result of that, we narrowed our focus to trying to identify those things that we thought were critical to bring forward to you as a legislature in 2015, both policy and funding-wise, to identify what sources of funds would be needed for those policy implementations or which funds needed to be raised and why, and to make a good prioritized list followed with a good explanation as to why those things were critical so that you as the legislator would have good arguments to back up any decisions you could make. The four groups that we created, one is dealing with how do we maintain and operate our existing system, all modes. Two, how do we enhance and grow the system, all modes that we need to make Oregon economically viable going into the future and to move the public and freight effectively and efficiently. What sort of innovative strategies do we need to be looking at? And then how do we communicate those needs effectively and efficiently? And in addition to that, how do we educate people who are coming into the role as legislators going forward? As some of you know, becoming a member of a transportation committee is a bit like drinking from a fire hose at times. You're going to have a lot of new members coming in, and the key thing is to provide an educational opportunity that doesn't involve the lobby. So with that, I'm going to turn over the detailed discussion to my colleagues to my left and right, who are going to go through the work of the subgroups, and I'm going to slip back so that they can get to the microphones.
Thank you.
Unless you have any questions for me.
Looks like you're okay. Thank you.
Chair Benz, Vice Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Dees. I'm the organizer of
We got a switch. That was good. I'm the Chair Benz, Vice Chair. Yeah, switched them around. It's all good.
Yeah. It's only with respect. One of you was staring at me.
That's okay.
Confused.
It's okay.
Right.
Bradley Elton.
Thank you. Let me begin. My group, I was tasked with organizing the, we call it the fix-it group, but really it's maintenance and operations. It's not what we're going to be building that's new. It's going to be what is the scope of need for maintaining what we have. And Carmen, in her comments, mentioned, I think pretty well, the scope of the problem. If you fail to maintain your roads, they degrade and they become much more expensive to maintain. So our group is focused much of its attention on trying to get our head around how you describe the need, how you determine the need, and how you describe it without slipping into the black hole of need, which is it's the need so big there's no way we can deal with it. So we're just not going to deal with it. The solution we're looking for is coming up with a range of choices on how to address the needs in a way that we can see results, we can sort of hit some targets. It's a pretty difficult challenge, and we've started, especially in the operations, especially on the maintenance component, we've started digging into how do we organize this information. So it's a challenge. And it's also, we've determined, too, that it's not necessarily the sexiest component of the transportation package because it's not really getting anything new. It's just keeping what you want, but keeping what you have. But it's, if you look at polling, you look at research that's been done, folks out in Oregon identify it as a very important component. It is maybe the most important component, not to make my group seem all that awesome. I'd like to just quickly go to a couple the key areas in which we've been looking at. This is really preliminary. We're not trying to railroad any sort of certain path. The first one, obviously, is operations and maintenance. Looking at maybe developing a few paths to give you selections to what you could buy rather than just saying everything. The numbers are large, and so we're trying to make them a little less scary. We've also been tasked with looking at transit funding, but not necessarily the big transit funding, but maybe some more targeted transit funding. I know Landauer's group is looking at the larger dedicated, how do we tackle state need. But looking at how do we target helping folks, people with disabilities and seniors in communities get around, how to provide federal match, a few other things like that. Also been looking at the bicycle and pedestrian issues. Is there a maintenance and component to that? That's a question mark. I think we think there probably is, but we're not sure. And then ports, locks, other such things. Again, Landar's helping you out with that one. It's not my strong suit. And then the final one is looking at the allocation we have, the 50-30-20, and this is maybe a contentious subject, but we're looking at are there ways of targeting funding to achieve goals better than general targeting. It's not, and so the cities and counties are hopefully going to be taking the lead on that along with ODOT to try to see if there are better ways. So we have a pretty broad and difficult task ahead of us, but we realize that any package that gets put forth needs to have some of this background done ahead of time. So that's what our group's target is. So thanks. Any questions? I'll be glad to answer. Landar.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landar. I have been given the unique opportunity to chair what we have termed, at least for the moment, the enhanced group. Our group is really looking at what does Oregon need to do in order to invest for the future, larger capacity, new environmental standards, various goals that the commission and the legislature have want to meet in the future. And so what we're looking at is effectively system expansion. Okay, what do you need to buy in order to accommodate population growth in the future? Obviously, as Ms. Four explained previously, much of our system has reached its useful life. We have a larger share of ongoing revenues being dedicated to bonded indebtedness. The fleets are becoming more fuel efficient. User fees that we currently use in at least the highway side have remained flat for some time and don't keep pace with inflation. The deterioration of the system, so on and so forth. And so there is clearly a very significant unmet need. And so we, in looking at it from our group standpoint, we're frankly somewhat overwhelmed by the need. And there are plenty of studies and documents produced by ODOT and others that can identify where we could do system expansions. And frankly, our group was somewhat overwhelmed with that. Our group is looking at both the highway side and the non-roadway side, so all modes, bike, ped, freight, air, marine, so on and so forth. And so we decided, frankly, to start with a proposal rather than going through the voluminous amounts of information that we could use to identify projects that we would want to perhaps pay for. So ultimately, what we have done is has come up with a, for lack of a better term, a straw man proposal. And that proposal effectively would, and this is where you can begin to hold your breath, suggest a 5-cent gas tax increase. This would solely be for the highway side. Existing ODOT federal and state funds amount to about $319 million. 76% of that, or about $243 million of that, goes to current maintenance and operations. About 24%, or more precisely, $76.8 million of that existing money is now going to what we call the enhanced program, system expansion. What this nickel would do, we would dedicate 50% of that nickel, 2.5 cents, or $66.75 million annually, to the enhanced program. That would increase or nearly double the enhanced program through ODOT, okay, for a grand total of about $143 million annually. Of course, some of that money could be bonded for larger projects, but nevertheless, it would ultimately result in a nearly doubling of ODOT's ability to expand the current system. The other 50% of that would we haven't quite decided how we want to go forward, but there are a couple of options. One, of course, would be to do the traditional split with the counties and the cities. Here you go, counties, 30% of that 66.75, and cities, here's your, effectively, it's actually 60% of the 50% to the counties and 40% of the 50% to the cities. The problem with that approach, though, of course, is that there are some very small cities who, there's an example, I forget which city it is, I've got the list here, that would end up with $400.
Is it in Representative Benson's district?
It could very well be.
Chair Benson's district?
Yes,
co-chair, sorry.
We're thinking that $400 might buy you a crosswalk striping in the middle of the night with somebody with a roller and a can of paint. So there's another potential way to do it, and that would be to dedicate that money to the MPOs and ACTS, whereby local jurisdictions could think together as to what are the high priority projects. You can actually get more money to those various entities than if you use the traditional funding formula. Now, the second side of the equation for the non-highway, of course, you can't use gas registration user fees for the traditional highway. We have perhaps naively thought that we could suggest to the legislature that perhaps 18% of the lottery could be, in fact, dedicated for the non-highway transportation needs of the state. A couple years ago, in 2011, the governor, then governor, appointed a non-roadway highway funding task force, and that task force identified an annual need of somewhere in the neighborhood of $530 to $580 million annually for non-highway needs. Well, this modest proposal would generate approximately $200 million a biennium to address those very significant needs. Half of that money under this proposal would go for active transportation, bicycle, pedestrian, as well as passenger rail. The other 50% would go to marine, air, and freight rail. If my memory serves me correctly, it does. It would be distributed in a fashion similar to the existing Connect process, by which 10% would be guaranteed to each ODOT region, and the remaining 50% would be up on a competitive basis. Now, we recognize that limiting the legislature's authority to expend those funds is a tall ask. The needs are rather significant, as I described earlier. We are going back and looking at alternative options for funding. That report that I mentioned to you previously identified nearly 60 potential funding sources for non-roadway transportation expenditures, and we will continue to look at those options, but at this point, that's where our group stands. And I'd just like to make one more mention of one further component, orphan highways. There is a lot of discussion that takes place around jurisdictional transfers. The problem, of course, is that there isn't much money that goes along with those jurisdictional transfers. One of the ideas that we have come up with is potentially adding another penny, and that money, which would generate somewhere on the order of just south of $27 million annually, would follow to the jurisdiction that ultimately takes over that existing facility. So a lot more work to be done, a lot more discussion to be had, but that's where our group stands at this point, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Let's get the overview from all of you, and then we'll imagine we'll have some conversation.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Bentz, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm also on the board of the Oregon Transportation Forum. And in the very first meeting of the large overall group, I think I barked a little bit about how the transportation package of the future shouldn't necessarily look like the transportation package of the past, and was rewarded with the gavel for the group with the longest name. The subgroup on innovation, efficiency, policy, and integration. I think we're going to have t-shirts made because it's so catchy. But we just call ourselves the innovation subgroup, and we've had actually very fruitful discussions. We started with a big blue sky conversation that filled a whiteboard in a conference room up at Metro. And we've had a couple of the members of your committee that have been participating actively in our subgroup. I appreciate their input. We've had a broad representation from across the spectrum, sort of like a miniature version of the overall OTF. We've also had a lot of active members. After our second meeting, we solicited a number of sort of policy proposals from the group, and I received a whole number of them. I'm not going to go through all of them here, just in the interest of time, but I am going to mention the two that are sort of the most overarching and biggest, I think at this stage, biggest priorities for the group. The first is has to do with indexing of fixed transportation fees, the gas tax, but not just the gas tax, also things like the vehicle registration fee, weight mile truck fees, and titling fees, et cetera. Those fees are fixed irrespective of population growth and inflation and changes in travel behavior and changes in technology, and especially the gas tax, as you know, has been eroding both in its actual receipts because of fuel efficiency, increased fuel efficiency of the fleet, and also because of inflation. Over time, that basically erodes the purchasing power of the gas tax. While fuel efficiency doesn't affect title fees and registration fees and the like, inflation does affect how far those monies go in providing services to Oregonians. And so we have recommended in our subgroup that we take a very, very close look at indexing these fees, the gas tax and the other fees. And our work plan for the summer is to try to do some number crunching and some identification of different indexes that might be worth taking a look at. There are certainly some ways that you can look at the construction cost index, for instance, and it's kind of volatile. How would you temper that volatility? Would you want to put a cap on any kind of increases? Would you want to have a sunset? There's all kinds of ways that you may want to limit or temper an inflation-related multiplier for these fees. But certainly we've all seen the increases in fuel economy that, in fact, I think from 2011 to 2012, the increase in fuel economy of the fleet was the second largest in the last 30 years. And so we're seeing a lot of technological changes that are going to really affect the ability for the gas tax to continue to function. Now, indexing the gas tax we view not as a final answer or, by the way, not as an answer to the expansion needs that Mr. Landauer was just discussing. It's really a way to just keep up with where we already are and keep from losing ground on maintenance. So indexing of these fees is not a way to raise new money. It does raise more money than if you don't, but it's not a way to buy anything new. It's a way to keep being able to buy what we're buying right now in terms of maintenance and preservation and operations without losing ground. And we also view this notion as an interim step, certainly not a final answer, something that would help us to kind of stay afloat as a state on maintaining our system while we continue to explore more innovative options, the road user fee that you've all discussed quite extensively, and other even more ambitious notions about how you might make the system pay for itself and incorporate the costs that people impose on the system into the price they pay to use the system. There's a lot of long-term work going on that front. But I just wanted to put that out there. This is one major area of focus for our group, and we'll be doing a lot more research and hopefully bring you some numbers and some more interesting information over the summer and see what your reactions are. The other major thing I wanted to mention is that it's been over 20 years since the completion of the last highway needs analysis in Oregon, and our group is talking about proposing something that would be sort of an update to that. It would not be just a highway needs analysis. It would be a transportation needs analysis, looking at the whole system, and it wouldn't be a rubber or a carbon copy of what was done 20 years ago, but it would be the analysis 20 years ago was the basis for developing the 50-30-20 distribution that exists today, and it also provided essentially a quantitative underpinning for understanding the needs of the system, and that's what we really need, is a better sense of what the needs are of the system, again avoiding what Mr. Dees described as the black hole of need, putting some limitations in terms of time and magnitude on what we're looking at. But there are a welter of individual separate plans that the state has right now, either existing or under development, from the highway plan, the intelligent transportation systems plan, the aviation plan, the bike and ped plan, the public transit plan, the passenger rail plan, the freight plan, the safety plan, etc. We want to try to bring those together into an analysis that takes a limited in time look at identifying needs, and it overlaps a lot with the work that Aaron was just describing a little bit earlier. And what we're proposing is not that we do that work. We can't do it. What we're proposing and anticipate bringing forward to you as an actual legislative request would be that the legislature fund ODOT to do that work after the 2015 session. And so we'll be working this summer to refine that notion, make it something that we can explain fully and it's much more manageable, also to try to quantify what we think that might cost and that sort of thing, and bring that forward to you as the year progresses, if things continue on the path they're on. So I'm going to stop there. We have, as I said, several other concept papers that came forward, everything from scenario planning for greenhouse gas reduction to co-location of facilities to, for efficiency. I'm just not going to go into all those right now, but I think those two that I mentioned are the big ticket items, or the big marquee items in our subgroup, and happy to take any questions about those.
Thanks. Let's hear from Mr. Hagedorn, and then we'll have some questions.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today in my capacity as chair of the subgroup on communications and strategy. It's exactly what it sounds like. We're sort of the group's lobby organization. The recognition, obviously, is that these are kind of big look, big picture asks, things that have been percolating the building in the past. And we recognize that because the forum is unique in its composition, that we have a big tent with a lot of stakeholders in the transportation conversation. We also needed to be able to prevail upon all of you and the governor that some of these ideas are good ones. Our subgroup is at a little bit of a deficit at this stage, given the fact that we don't know what ultimately the other three subgroups will conclude is the best policy approach moving forward. However, we have identified a number of initiatives that we can begin undertaking now. As Mr. Campbell indicated, we're seeing significant attrition in the Legislative Assembly. So there's a lot of education to do with folks that will be members of the Assembly going into the 2015 session that aren't here yet, that may not have a deep knowledge and understanding of transportation needs, transportation finance, and those kinds of things. So we're going to begin a work plan to do outreach there. Obviously, it will also involve communicating with you and your Senate counterparts about whatever it is that we decide to bring forward. There's also a substantial research component here, and some of you who are around back in 2008 may recall that we had a strategic partnership with Willamette University, who assisted us with some of the policy research there. We're going to do that again. So we've already reached out to them so that when we bring you a proposal, it's backed by real policy research that you can look to. Secondly, it's also our observation and experience from the 09 transportation package that survey research going out and talking to the public about their interest in transportation infrastructure is an important component of our advocacy efforts here in the Capitol building, and I think is a meaningful thing for all of you to know before you take a vote on something that may well be controversial in your district. So we're going to do that due diligence as well. And then lastly, as we get into the legislative session and we know kind of where the other three subgroups are headed, and the final board makes its observations and provides direction to our subgroup, we'll pull together all the collateral advocacy materials. We'll be visiting with all of you and your counterparts, working with the governor's staff, who has been graciously involved in the forum from the get-go. And again, many of you on this committee and over on the Senate side and the Business of Transportation Committee also are involved. So we thank you for your attention and participation. We look forward to continuing conversation. And we know there's a lot of work yet to be done. We want your input. So I think you'll be hearing from members of my subgroup in regular fashion. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to give you an update.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you guys' work, and those of us from the eastern part of the state, and I know a bunch of my constituents are here, which I'm very happy to see, understand the value of transportation systems, since we have so much ground across which we must travel to, for example, be here today. And so the component of having counties have adequate funding for county roads is an element that's absolutely essential if rural legislators are going to be able to support this effort. That's one. Here's the second. Some time ago, I forgot which one of these committees we were talking about, the peanut butter theory, and that is we take all of our dollars and we spread them across the state evenly without regard to return on investment.
That's in lots of committees.
Yeah, right. made me reflect a bit on the thinking that had to go into the gas tax and how carefully it was allocated back to the cities and the counties and the state. And one of the things that came up in our discussion on the bridge project was the fact that the state might well find itself investing huge amounts of all of its money in an improvement in infrastructure that benefited primarily Portland. And so the question then became, well, why can't Portland pay for more of it, as opposed to drawing in every bit of money from all of the states and just dumping it in Portland? But it works both ways, doesn't it? We should be asking ourselves, how much more are those areas that are going to enjoy the economic return going to be paying? And so I'm very interested in that aspect of what you're doing. And it's not a new concept. It's just one that I need to be clearer on. So when I go back home and I'm out in Burns or in Lakeview or in John Day explaining this, I can say, yes, those people who are enjoying the bigger dollars are paying more. I need to be able to say that. And I know I understand some of the counter arguments, but those two points I need help on. And the final thing, in the conversation at noon today on the road user task force, the issue, Drew, that you brought up of letting the broader community of Oregon know why we're doing this and why we have to do it. Those of us that have to go back home don't enjoy being attacked in our town hall meetings for having supported an infrastructure vote. We would much rather have had somebody doing the explaining before we get home. And so that piece is really big. That, and I hate to call it the education piece, but at least it's the please share this so that we're not run up some sort of the nearest flagpole when we get to those meetings. So, there's three thoughts.
Thank you.
Good ones.
Others?
I'm interested, Mr. Landauer, particularly you noted, I'm sure, the resounding applause that you
yes.
heard when you talked about dedicating further percentages of the lottery. You also mentioned...
I failed to mention it was a constitutional dedication, but that was... you know, that was
oh, well, that changes everything.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Thanks for that clarification, yes. I also heard you talk about a list of, I think you said 60 different mechanisms. I don't want you to list all 60 today or recite them, but if there are others that are worth our consideration, if there are highlights, maybe you could hit those.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I'll be more than happy to share the full report with committee staff so that can be
great.
Distributed to the to the full committee, and I have shared it with at least one member already. A couple of the ideas, and you know, remember, this was back in, most of this work took place back in 2011, and it was actually co-chaired by Senator Beyer and Mayor Phil Hauck from Pendleton, and many of the folks were in on that committee. Some of those ideas included employer payroll taxes, real estate-related taxes, value-added taxes to lands that, for example, come into an urban growth boundary. There's a mechanism to capture some of that increased value that occurs when land is actually brought into urban growth boundaries. Interestingly, advertising revenues for placards along highways, so on and so forth. So there were a number of different ideas out there. Ultimately, though, Mr. Chair, it was interesting that group landed on the lottery as being the most palatable funding source for non-roadway. And as this august body has done in the past, you've moved five Oregon Connect programs forward. And so it seemed like a natural fit, but again, as I will remind the committee, we are happy and will be going back to the drawing board to look at other potential viable options.
Perhaps there are ways to define more things as parks. Might be interesting too.
We can ride bikes
in
parks.
Yes, yeah, right.
Transportation park and rides.
Missed the last part. Other questions for this group? Let's see. Thank you very much for being here. We'll certainly invite you back in September and want to hear more about your work.
Thank you.
Thanks
thank
very
you
much.
Thank you for your good work. Maybe
we'll don't get me started. Turn the DMV into a...
It's one on the freeway.
So we're going to welcome now Team Juniper, and Representative Benz has unfortunately another obligation that he has to get to. I know he's he can speak for himself. I know he's grateful for the folks being here.
Oh, I'm very happy they're here, but it looks I ran out of egg to avoid listening to the Juniper thing. Now I'm run out. That's not the truth. I very much wish I could stay, but I have a leadership meeting I have to go to, so.
Understood.
Good luck.
Thank you. We'll be nice to you, we promise. So let's invite our first panel, Dan Nichols, Gerard Lebrecht, and Ryan Temple, please. Hopefully I got something close on those names. Here we come. So we're grateful to Nancy Hamilton, whom we'll hear from in a bit, for letting the committee know that you all were going to be here already in a Senate committee. And since you made the trip, we thought it would be good to hear from you. I think you probably were talking particularly about the agricultural elements of your work in the Senate. This is the Transportation Economic Development Committee. And as is often the case, there's some overlap between economic development and other things. So we're grateful to hear from you and eager to learn from your work. Please.
I guess I've been elected to begin.
Congratulations.
For the record, my name is Dan Nichols, and I've been privileged and honored to have served fifth term as Harney County Commissioner. I've also been a rancher in Diamond Valley at the base of Steens Mountain for 35 years. That's a little bit of background from where I come from and where my address is coming from. Economic development in Eastern Oregon has been an uphill battle for 25 to 30 years. We lost the milling industry approximately that long ago. Just due to logistics, transportation costs, all of the business associated things to entice somebody to come to a small rural community, it's been difficult. Recently, there's been a small but significant positive change in that whole scenario. And that is the universal acknowledgement of Western Juniper encroachment into the sagebrush steppes of Eastern Oregon and the impact it has to sage-grouse habitat, watersheds, and the impairment of natural rejuvenation of woody species such as quaking aspen and mountain mahogany. That plus the increasing awareness of the attributes of juniper as a construction and building material and product by consumers is influencing the business potential for the Western juniper market. put my glasses on, I might be able to read. My apologies.
No problem.
Harney County has recognized this incredible economic potential for years. Our community is engaged in several feasibility studies and market evaluations for juniper utilization, from juniper oil to the assessment of juniper supply on public as well as private land. The repeated and traditional process was to acquire a grant, conduct studies, accumulate data, assess the viability of supply versus demand, retain one non-resident consultant for a period of approximately 6 months, and then file a completed report on the economic development shelf because it had nothing included in the process to address the needs and financial realities of the private entrepreneurs in the community. That scenario changed for the positive 5 years ago in Harney County. An extremely successful juniper entrepreneur approached the county with the business concept. Over the course of the winter, an innovative and sound business plan was formulated by Joseph Juniper Incorporated. The county, knowing that business people can and will create jobs when enabled to do so, and understanding that traditional financial assistance has been limited to help fledgling businesses, prompted the Harney County Court to build a reserve account to be utilized for financial assistance for the development of a wood product industry within the county. With that funding available from the county and at the request of from Joseph Junipers for assistance, the county court reviewed the plan, discussed the pros and cons, and ultimately agreed to provide a financial package based on job creation in Harney County. It has been a tremendously successful venture, not only for Joseph Junipers Incorporated, but for Harney County as a whole. In addition to meeting all of the financial obligations to the county in the first year, Joseph Junipers invested more than the initial value that the county provided the business. They invested more back into the community in the first year in goods and services procured for the benefit and use of the corporation. Essentially, 9 new jobs were created in the community, and in 2011, those 9 jobs were equivalent to the creation of 1,305 jobs in the greater Portland metro area. And these aren't, that is a ratio determined and developed from the state statistician's office. This year, 2014, Joseph Juniper will employ 12 people, or an equivalent of roughly 2,400 jobs in the Portland metro area. We are firm believers in Harney County that little by little soon becomes a lot. That's a huge impact from one investment, one company, and the motivation of one husband-wife entrepreneurial team. Another success story, an offshoot, and one that we all hope to see statewide with increased economic development. Of those jobs that were offered, one man that had been away out of the county for 3 years working out of state was able to come back to Harney County, reside with his family, and return home after 3 years of being employed outside of the state. Another huge success and part of economic development in a small community. County government provided assistance to a business, and the realities of success are abundantly clear. As a founding member of the Western Juniper Utilization Group, Harney County fully supports the policy priorities as submitted by the group. State investment in rural businesses can and will provide significant process in the economic development of rural communities. Functioning outside the parameters of the traditional box has paid huge dividends to the Harney County economy. The same accomplishments can be made throughout rural Oregon to help local economies and to promote the growing juniper utilization movement. We would request that a great deal of consideration and ultimate approval be given to the priority of providing forgivable loans for Western Juniper entrepreneurs and to introduce and implement a shared risk funding model for financial assistance. through state economic development, sage-grouse habitat restoration, watershed enhancement, job creation, and multiple returns to rural community business centers are a small listing of the potential returns to rural counties that will be realized from such a program. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon.
Thank you very much for making the trip and for your testimony. Let's hear from your colleagues, please. We'll probably have questions after that. Who's next?
Chair Reed and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about the real future of Eastern Oregon through the harvest and utilization of Western juniper. I am Gerard Joseph LeBrecq, part owner and employee of Joseph Juniper Incorporated, which, because of time, I will start referring to it as JJI.
Civilization.
We as a company ecologically restore the rangeland in eastern Oregon to a more native state with 75% juniper utilization going through my portable mills. JJI has a 10-year stewardship to remove with the Andrews District BLM. 800 to 1,000 acres will be processed 214, 215. We purchased delivered juniper logs from three separate rangeland managers within the Eastern Oregon region. I have a private land contract for 316 acres of downed juniper removal that will go into lumber. At present, I have five employees working in the inventory yard, a logistical financial manager, one person in a payroll company, a satellite palletized firewood company of two, and by June 10th, I will hire three to five more employees for rangeland restoration, which just roughly equates to 2,400 jobs in the Portland metropolitan area, if I am not mistaken. America was built on dreams, and Oregon is part of America. It is time to step up to the plate and support the recovery of Eastern Oregon through the juniper industry. JJI will consider providing a site for a stationary juniper and small diameter wood site. With your belief in the restoration of the juniper rangeland and the future of the region of Eastern Oregon, JJI supports the efforts of the Western Juniper Utilization Group. You, as the leaders of the great state of Oregon, need to step up to the plate financially and assist the juniper industry to finally get over the top. This is a win-win for those involved and those to be involved. With these thoughts, you must realize all of this restoration will provide a huge impact of a positive nature on the sage-grouse in its domain. I thank the Harney County Court for believing in JJI, financially assisting the company. In return, JJI hired nine family wage jobs and showed a 38% profit in its first year of doing business as a mill company. In closing, I say support the future of the next generation of the secondary wood industry, the Western juniper tree. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. LeBrecq. Please.
Thank you, Gerard. Chairman Reed, members of the committee, thank you for providing us the opportunity to come to you here and talk to you today about juniper. My name is Ryan Temple. I'm the president of Sustainable Northwest Wood. That's a wholesale distribution yard in Portland. We exclusively carry woods from the Pacific Northwest, and we distribute that across the region. Essentially, I connect Oregon forest products to the building trades across the West. Of all the products I carry, I am more excited about the potential of juniper than anything else, and let me tell you why. There's a lot of talk about sustaining forest, and while that is incredibly important, we have a unique opportunity here, which has to do with restoring ecosystems. I know that with every stick of juniper I sell, I am conserving soil in eastern Oregon, improving watershed health in eastern Oregon, creating habitat for endangered species like sage grouse we heard about in the other committee, and improving the conditions of rangeland upon which the ranchers in the eastern half of our state so heavily depend. But the story runs deeper than that. It also has to do with economic development. When we talked about the listing a little while ago, the concern was the jobs that could be eliminated through the listing of the sage grouse. Uniquely, activities that would avoid this listing can create jobs. I think the easiest way for me to describe this is to provide an example of a project we're in the midst of right now. Juniper harvested in eastern Oregon creates jobs for loggers there, truckers to move that wood from the forest, from the rangeland to the mill, milling jobs in Fossil, Oregon on this particular project. That wood in turn travels to Oregon, where it creates jobs at Trillium Pacific Millwork in Hubbard, Oregon to finish that wood. Then Finish Line Industries in Newburgh, Oregon, which puts a coating on that wood. And finally, that wood will end up at the Portland Airport, where Howard S. Wright Construction will create jobs installing it there. The jobs created in eastern Oregon are incredibly important, especially given the impoverished nature and a high unemployment in many parts of that state. But the multiplier effects really underscore the true impact that juniper utilization can have across our entire state. It is an Oregon export. This is a wood that is unique to the state of Oregon, and we are the leaders in promoting this wood and developing markets for it. Right now, Gerard's busy cutting a job for me, which will end up at the University of Washington in Tacoma, a truckload of juniper heading up there. But we could do more. We've barely scratched the surface of what the opportunity is here for all of us. So why not? Why aren't we doing more? Businesses all face challenges. With small rural businesses, those challenges are especially acute. Access to capital, access to markets, access to technical resources, assistance, workforce training, all of these things are critical to the success of small businesses like Gerard's. And so we come before the committee today asking for your ideas about things that we can do together to address these challenges. Each of the great things about juniper on their own are special. But when you look at all of them together, the opportunity to create jobs, conserve ecosystems, conduct responsible rangeland management, it creates a truly unique opportunity where forest policy is so often identified by compromise, where everyone leaves the table feeling like they've given up something. We have an opportunity here for everybody to walk away knowing they're moving forward together. So I thank you for your time, and I look forward to working with all of you to make this happen.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. Representative Pressure.
Thanks. I have a couple questions, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
So can you tell us a little bit about the juniper itself? I mean, it's a softwood. How fast does it grow? What are you doing to replace what you're taking out, or is it just totally something that just needs to come out because it needs to come out, or are you putting more back in? What does that actually look like? I'll ask that because I'm working on a project in Clackamas right now that we're actually bringing two bills forward on a different an urban lumber project where my senator is interested in doing some pilot funding with the Clackamas Forester for a program that we're trying to do there. And I'm just wondering if there's some synergies that might fit that project and maybe rope what you guys are doing into a more wide pilot.
Maybe I can add to your question, which just in a way of just displaying my own ignorance, what is it about juniper that is interesting and different than other sorts of wood?
Why don't you talk about the harvesting and I'll talk about the wood. You work with the chainsaw, you know that side of things.
There's approximately 9 million acres of juniper in eastern Oregon. My numbers are going to be a little off because I wasn't quite born yet. About 1940, no offense, man. About 1940 or so, give or take, there was only 1.5 million acres of juniper in eastern Oregon. More credibly explained as the old growth that was in the rock rims where the natural forest fires could never get to it. And then the seedlings started. The lumber, the trees I harvest are somewhere between 100 and 150 years old because they are so slow growing. They are a subspecies of the cedar, and through tests at Oregon State University, a 6x6 with 65% heartwood, 8-foot long fence posts, showed the first indication of rot in 30 years. That's one of the things that makes it so unique, and it is naturally organic, made by the good Lord. I could not get it certified by Oregon Tilth, very large certification company down in Corvallis, Oregon, because it's naturally organic. And in this day and age, the consumer is so green that he buys because he's helping jobs in Eastern Oregon, he's saving the watershed, and he's improving the rangeland back to its native state where this juniper never was before. So sustainability of this tree, when you think about 9 million acres, and I think if I'm healthy for another year or two, I might get up to 2,000 acres in 1 year, 3-4 years, and then the inaccessibility of the rest of the juniper, it will be there forever.
So it looks like Oregon State University has put some effort into juniper in terms of trying to decide if it's, you know, something we should be looking at. It looks like they've got fact sheet and harvesting and manufacturing and different product uses. Are you working with them at all?
Yes. Yes, Scott Levengood. I don't know, Scott. Well, he's right behind us here with the Oregon Wood Innovation Center, as I've been working with us on some of these things. Most of the juniper right now is being applied in a landscape application where the durability features that Gerard describes are so important, especially for those who want to avoid chemicals in the garden applications. But there's a whole lot more potential for it in the use of other applications, but better understanding its mechanical properties, how it would respond to stress testing and so forth, for highway guardrails, construction applications. That work needs to be done in order to gain approval in those other applications.
And last follow-up, and I know Representative McKeon's in the queue too.
Yep.
So the project I'm working on is a hardwood. We're looking at actually doing hardwood planting in infill spaces, so white oak down the center of 205 for wine barrels or whatever. And we actually put our first trees in the ground in Clackamas. We've got 9 or 10 partners. We're looking to bring some legislation in 2015. And like I said, also asking the legislators, Senator Devlin is open to asking for some pilot dollars. So I'm curious what your ask is. Like, what's the roadblock to working on this as an industry in Oregon, you know, in Harney County and Eastern Oregon? Is it capital? Is it expertise? OIT, Oregon Tech, in the Wilsonville campus is one of the pilot partners in the Clackamas Hardwood Forest Project and has said that if we get this off the ground, they would actually be interested in bringing back, you know, some milling science classes potentially as, you know, looking at needing to kind of reinvigorate that industry. So what's the ask from us? Because, you know, like I said, I'd be curious to see how we maybe marry these two things together moving forward in 2015.
Right. Well, when you ask the question of what the challenges are, classically the answer is somewhat of all of the above. Typical in any sort of economic development, as the supply and the markets need to move incrementally forward together, there is a supply side of things. How do we free up more juniper on the landscape and create more restoration activity? And so I think that there's opportunities that can be acted upon at the state level to free that up. And to speak on behalf of the mills, I think that there is a capital issue that has to do with both equipment for taking this industry to scale, and it also has to do with capitalization of the raw materials that are needed. How can we acquire a log deck sufficient enough to keep us through a season where we don't have access to logs and keep productivity going? And there's a market side of things. This is a nascent product. It's one of the things that's most exciting about it, but it's also one of the things that's most challenging about it. And so how can we brand it effectively, brand it around the state of Oregon, and reach a broad marketplace with that brand
to grow that opportunity and increase the demand for it so that it'll be in place when the supply comes along.
Is the supply on state land? I mean, who owns the supply?
Federal, private,
okay.
All of the above on those
lands.
Okay. Representative, an answer more fully to your question, other speakers later will
And I have to leave early, which is why, but
We'll have them back sometime.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And if you have other people coming to speak, they may answer my question. And if so, I apologize for asking it early. But Commissioner, I want to tell you I spent 4 summers in the Blitzen Gorge. And out of that, for a week every summer, we had to come down to Diamond and Buck Hay to help pay our way. And so I've seen your part of the country. And since I was a youngster, we've hunted and fished and hiked all of that country. And you come from the most beautiful place in the world. How lucky are you to live over there? There's no better place. And I want to make sure I pronounce this correctly. Is it Lebrecht?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Lebrecht, thank you so much for your entrepreneurial spirit and your willingness to invest your time and energy in something that's really a critical need in the state. I have family that ranches over at Mitchell, and they're spending a tremendous amount of effort and money trying to eradicate juniper on their rangeland, first of all, to save water. Second of all, they have pictures that go back 50, 60 years of what the rangeland looked like then and what it looks like now, and it is transformed. And I believe is this not designated as an invasive species on our rangeland?
I think it was last year.
This is an incredible problem that you are beginning to help eradicate in a way that everybody wins. And I'm very impressed with the work that you're doing. And I wanted to ask if you have had Nexus or been working with Business Oregon on these projects.
I have tried.
Okay.
Sometimes I have difficulty in the bureaucracy of it all. When you need 45 pages of application, and they're a very good firm. Do not misunderstand me, please. But by the time I get it all filled out, I got 7 months because of weather. Mm-hmm. To produce and harvest juniper.
And so you'd rather be out harvesting juniper.
Yes, ma'am.
Understood.
Perhaps we can help on that.
Yes, I was going to say we may be able to find some resources to assist you with that, because that, I don't know what's available at this point in time, but I would suggest that may be some place that you go. You collectively could go, and maybe, Commissioner, you could help in trying to get hooked up with some of the resources the Business Oregon can provide in access to capital. And I'm just thank you for your good work.
Thank you.
Mr. Temple, is Sustainable Northwest Wood part of the broader Sustainable Northwest of Martin Goble and John Audley?
Yes, we're a wholly owned subsidiary of. So we spun off 5 years ago as a Chapter C for-profit corporation that's owned by the nonprofit.
Thank you. So we have 3 more people to hear from as well. We greatly appreciate you coming, and I'm excited about what may be possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Hamilton and King and Zach Williams, please.
Didn't used to be there.
It's the largest forest in the United States.
We have one Williams.
Yeah. One Williams.
Okay.
We're dividing and conquering this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman Reed and members of the committee. I'm Zach Williams, and I'm from King Inc., and we are a consultant hired by Sustainable Northwest on behalf of Western Juniper Utilization Group to deal with the supply side of the juniper issue. So I'll try to address some of the questions we had during the course of my somewhat prepared testimony, but like I heard over there, it's changed a little bit from what I've heard you guys have said.
Thanks.
So thanks for listening to us talk about Western juniper utilization. Representative McKeown, you hit on it right off the bat that this is a problem it's kind of a good problem to have. We need rid of it, and we can utilize it. So kind of everyone wins. But what we were hired to do was some specific tasks, but to get to the who's supplying it and where is it. It's on private ground. It's on federal ground. A lot of the really good stuff's on federal ground. One of the tasks we had was increasing the supply from federal ground. As you guys may know, federal ground goes through projects. They go through an environmental analysis. A lot of juniper is taken off of these projects or cut down, but it's not analyzed for removal. And when it's not analyzed for removal, then it's not allowed to be removed. So it gets cut and left, or it gets cut and decked, but it can't be taken off because...
Sorry, what is cut and decked?
I'm sorry. Cut and skidded to a landing where it sits in a log deck.
Okay.
form where it's very easily stacked up. Yes, I'm sorry. It's like a stack of big wood. So on private ground, what we're attempting to do as a supply contractor is to connect the landowners who, through NRCS, ODF&W, ODF, OWEB, tribes, all kinds of different people are spending money cutting juniper. It's expensive to cut. A lot of landowners can't afford to do it, so they're being subsidized to do so. We're trying to focus on connecting those landowners that are being subsidized to cut juniper with the people who are wanting to utilize the juniper. You know, it's obviously, it subsidizes both that way. And what we're hoping to do is, with the added value of, you know, these guys can afford to pay a little bit for it. Now, landowners aren't going to get rich cutting juniper. That's not going to happen. But what they can do is reduce the amount of fuel on their property, and they can reduce the cost to the harvesters so that maybe they can get the product for cheaper, and the landowners get rid of the product, and the landowners get rid of the bole of the tree, which is the big part, the center part. They remove that, and the intensity of the fires reduces, and, you know, inherently can increase you know, sage-grouse habitat by reducing the intensity of burns. Another thing we are doing is coming up with a set of guiding principles or restoration standards. We've convened all of the people in Western Juniper Utilization to vet and hopefully agree upon a set of guiding principles for the restoration of these, of this property. It's already being done in these projects, don't get me wrong, but go ahead.
Sorry, excuse me.
I'm sorry, I couldn't get your attention.
Representative McKeown, sorry.
I'd like you to touch on one other thing that I think is, we don't want to lose sight of, and it's the fact that how much water a juniper sucks up in a season. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on that, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Kind of the number that's always thrown around is a kind of, let's say, 10-inch juniper, I think, takes 35 gallons of water per day. Mm-hmm. So we were on a project last week where there were 6,000 acres of juniper being cut at, I think, 350 stems per acre. And this is rough, crayon math, my dad would call it, but that's 72 million gallons of water a day. And I didn't try to do it times 365 days, but it's an enormous amount of water that's being sucked up by these juniper trees. So that's another reason why this is just, I mean, not to mention the native grasses that are improved, you know, the increase just in watershed soil retention. We don't lose soil into the water because the junipers suck up all the water, the grass dies, the soil's exposed, wind and water take the soil away.
I don't want to take you off track too much further, but just to extend that question one little bit, can you say something about the trajectory of this? I mean, even if we ramped up everybody who wanted to be harvesting, could we keep up? Is this a short-lived opportunity? Are we going to get rid of all the juniper over some period of time, or is this something that's always going to be there?
In a perfect world, yeah, it's a self-terminating problem, I guess, ideally, because it's not like forests where we want to sustain our yield.
Right.
We want to get rid of this, but there's 9 million acres, and like Gerard said, he's hoping to do 2,000 acres next year. Let's just double him and times it by the three guys that are really, really putting out juniper. 12,000 acres a year is not going to get us there very fast.
So agreed. But if we solve the capital problem and the equipment problem and everything else, is it feasible to catch up, or does it grow at such a rate that we're never going to catch up?
I think it grows fairly slowly, but I don't think we can catch up with it. What really needs to happen is fire needs to be introduced back on the landscape to continue. You know, you can't cut juniper probably often enough.
Okay.
So it's going to continue. Ideally, you could fix it if there was a large infusion of capital. That's going to get to the one of the things that mapping is another thing we were charged with doing. So Sage Grouse Initiative and Mule Deer Initiative and BLM and Nature Conservancy have put quite a bit of money into mapping juniper in Eastern Oregon. They did a portion of Eastern Oregon, the sage grouse part. What we need is money to complete basically that. Where is juniper in Eastern Oregon? Where's the good juniper? Good juniper, I mean commercial-sized juniper that grows in transitional areas on north aspects in the right soils and that kind of thing. So that's one of the things that helps for planning and for these guys who are milling the juniper. And like, I want to go back to guiding principles. That's what we're using as part of a branding mechanism to sell this wood on the west side and up in, you know, on the west coast, is we're restoring the ecology of Eastern Oregon, and we're doing it in a manner that's responsible. And these guiding principles, we're hoping to get broad buy-in from the Nature Conservancy and ONDA and all these other groups that are part of our organization to just kind of buy in on these are how we are harvesting. This is the way Girard does it. This is the way that people Kendall Hires does it. So we can brand it as green or certified as responsibly done. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Great stuff. Ms. Hamilton.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the Transportation and Economic Development Committee. Thanks for having us here today. We very much appreciate your time. I know I'm the last person between you and leaving, so I will try to be brief. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the Western Juniper Utilization Group. My firm, Nancy Hamilton Consulting, is working closely with King Inc. Under the project management of Sustainable Northwest to try to develop an actual viable business proposition from what started as a restoration effort. So as we've learned very well today, this Western Juniper is being harvested. It has to be. The water tables need to be restored. Sage-grouse habitat needs to be protected. Rangelands need to be brought back to life. But what we don't want to do is waste this opportunity to actually build rural jobs. And Representative Parrish asked earlier, and Chair Reed, you asked as well, what can we do to help these small businesses grow? And in my former tenure as Governor Kulongoski's senior policy advisor for economic development and workforce, and I oversaw Business Oregon as part of that responsibility, it is often difficult to find a right-sized solution for a small entity in a rural community. We tend to come in with solutions that are too big and too cumbersome, and Girard sort of very articulately noted that. It just doesn't work. There are other programs that are more right-sized for this sort of challenge, and one of our requests of this committee and of the legislature, we're working also very closely with the governor's office on this, is to find help on a few key areas from a demand side. One is if we want to scale up, people like Girard Lebrecq, he's at capacity. He needs another mill. He has no, banks aren't talking to folks like Girard Lebrecq. There is a program that Business Oregon has, a revolving loan program for water and wastewater systems. Those dollars can be forgiven if certain criteria are met. I would encourage us to look at a program that's modeled like that, where if folks like Girard and Kendall and LWO and others are creating jobs, we can forgive at least part, if not all, of those loans so that they can work with us to scale up this effort. The second thing that we feel is important is that if we start to scale up, we're going to need to be certified, not certified like LEED or FSC. We need to be certified, as Ryan Temple suggested, around structural integrity. What can you use this stuff for? What can't you use this stuff for? When we try to have juniper considered by ODOT, for instance, for posts and poles, their first question is it in the WWPA book or the AWPA book? It doesn't exist. It's not real in all of these organizations that are considering what to purchase and why. You don't want ODOT to buy a wood that's not going to hold up under whatever purpose the wood needs to be used. Certification costs money. Scott Levengood, OSU, the Wood Innovation Council can work with us on that certification process. It's a $200,000 cost. Capitalization efforts, infrastructure capitalization for folks like Girard, we're looking at $500,000 to $1 million just to get started. We also have, if we can get this certification when we've begun to scale up, say we're really selling at volume, we'll be ready for those kinds of opportunities. The next thing we also need, and folks have sort of mentioned it and I alluded to it, is we need right-sized business assistance. Girard shouldn't spend months putting together a very cumbersome bureaucratic application process to get help. One of our other millers is really needs business assistance. He's a great miller. He understands this wood. He knows how to get it to market. He needs basic business help. One of the jobs I've been tasked with is the notion of getting more education and awareness out. We're in the process of developing a website. We're putting together a video. I was just out in Burns last week, and Commissioner Nichols mentioned it, and I'd say it again. I chatted with this one gentleman who was practically in tears saying, I work in the wind turbine industry, but I live in Burns. I'm finally working at home and going home to my family at night. This stuff is deeply impactful in the these rural communities. They just need right-sized business assistance. Don't come in with a sledgehammer. Come in with the appropriate help. And I am in a position working with WJUG in part through the generosity of a general fund allocation from the legislature last year from through DAS and a $35,000 allocation from Business Oregon. And so we're going to encourage continued support on this front. We see just an extraordinary opportunity to get folks back to work out in places like Harney, Malheur, and Wheeler County. And we're happy to answer any questions you might have. Thanks so much for having us today.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
So this is an incredible project, and I'm trying to understand all the pieces and how it's come together. One of the things, so I'm still trying to understand some of where the money is coming from that's doing some of this, because obviously it takes money to invest to start with. And you talk about restoration work in that, and so who's paying for the restoration work in that? I mean, how does that tie? Because there's obviously not enough money from the logs of that at this point.
Well, it's an interesting conversation because, and Zach can fill in on this, but there is some money being invested by folks like Gerard Lebrecht. Uh-huh. BLM is paying to have a lot of these Western Juniper felled. And we have money from private organizations, state money, federal money to help put all the parts and pieces mm-hmm. together. And in addition to the BLM?
Yeah, well, NRCS and Soil and Water Conservation Districts specifically are spending a lot of money. Soil Watershed Councils and BLM and Forest Service, like I mentioned, they cut a lot of it, but we just need to make sure they get the message that we need to be able to utilize it after they've cut it. So
if I could just follow, yeah, so please. That's one thing that fascinates me, and I have a place in Central Oregon that's surrounded by juniper, and I've watched the BLM cut and burn the materials and stuff, and do that. So I'm still confused on what stops them. So if they cut the logs, what stops them from being able to sell the logs and move them?
Under the National Environmental Policy Act, they're required to analyze any major federal action for the cumulative effects of the action. And if one of the actions if they don't analyze for their actual removal of taking that log and putting it on a truck and taking it away, they can't do it.
But they can cut it down.
They can cut it down, absolutely. Yeah, it's the difference between a pre-commercial thin and a commercial thin.
Yeah.
They cut it and they leave it there, or they cut it and they take it off. And those are, if they don't analyze for it. And in the past, there was no industry, so there was no reason to analyze for it. So it's really just a message of information. They're receptive to it, so okay. I think that we should get there with that.
And just a footnote to that, I think the other issue, and Zach and King are both working diligently on this, is connecting ranchers with millers.
Sure.
And so, and a lot of the ranch owners don't want their names in big government databases. So we're actually working on a non-government related sort of match.com. I have this that's being harvested. You want to come get it? And they can work with each other directly without creating a bunch of middlemen that don't need to be there. And resources from the state can help us provide those sorts of resources for them.
If I could follow up on that, just
please.
A second.
Yep.
I actually owned, the reason I got involved with this, I had 120 acres of my own property that I cleared through SWCD money. And until I was able to get rid of the logs, which Prairie Wood Products, before they closed down, they used my juniper as a pilot for cogeneration of electricity with juniper. And as a landowner, I really didn't want to cut the juniper and leave it there. It creates a huge fire hazard if it's left. So when I was able to cut it and have it removed, I was more than happy to remove it. So it's also an incentive to landowners to cut their juniper.
Yep. So I just want to reinforce one more thing that you said, Nancy, and that I really appreciate. If the size of the program, like using a hammer versus, I mean, that's not just an issue, I can tell you, for small companies in Eastern Oregon. That's an issue for small companies anywhere, and that's a real problem we have in this state with the programs, good programs, but they're very hard to access by small companies because they're just, the complications are just too much, and so that's right on, and I appreciate your bringing that up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things have struck me about this. One is right-sized business assistance. That was the phrase you used. We heard earlier today from some people in the Eugene Springfield area about business incubator ideas and startups. And I was comparing what they described as the need there. Just like we think of roads and water as infrastructure, we need sort of an information and knowledge infrastructure to support business also. When I think about what's the appropriate role for an SBDC, what's the appropriate role for certain other entities, sometimes it just isn't the right thing for what, in particular, small businesses need at the time. So we need, I think, to give more thought to what is our infrastructure for helping business, either start up or in the early stages or thrive. Maybe we don't have our infrastructure quite right for referral and assistance. The other thing that strikes me is you made a comment, it was part of a longer sentence, banks aren't talking to businesses like Mr. Lebregs. Why? Just tell me fundamentally who's lending and who's not lending and why.
I don't know if Gerard wants to speak to this directly, but I can tell you that in general, small businesses are high-risk propositions. Mm-hmm. You put it in rural Oregon, it's a higher-risk proposition. You make it about timber, which is what a bank hears, even though that's not what the story is. You might as well just, go to the picnic.
A new type of timber that's less familiar.
And speculative and short-term in nature, because you don't have... Gerard happens to have a 10-year stewardship contract, which is new and great and but kind of unheard of, really. Sure. So until you get to those long-term situations, banks don't want to put money into somebody who may not have supply next year.
Right. But we've had this conversation, of course, where little bits of state money can serve as guarantees for those kinds of loans, mm-hmm. and leverage lots more. And I think there's mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to talk about here. Yeah.
Right.
So sorry to cut you off.
No, that's right. When we think about risk, it's not just about high-tech software startups or that kind of stuff. There's risk in all kinds of new business activities. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, I really appreciate you all coming, and I'm glad we were able to do it in a way that you got to be in front of two committees on one trip. I recognize I was raised in Idaho, so I have some sense of the distance, and I appreciate how far you've come. If you haven't read it, there's a great book Bill McDonough wrote called Cradle to Cradle, and one of his fundamental principles, which just seems so applicable here, is waste equals food, and the fact that there's, as you said, and I think Representative Lively, this is a problem that we have to get rid of, and we can benefit from at the same time. So I think there's lots to do here, and I hope we'll be able to make some progress with you in the session to come. So thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
That completes our agenda. Is there anything else we need to do today, Patrick? Anything else for the good of the order?
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you again in September.
One thing for the good of the order,
yes?
I would like to thank Commissioner-elect or Commissioner...
Whatever.
You are. For Marion County.
Yeah,
I do believe this is his last meeting.
We gave him a chance to give a speech, and he didn't do it.
We don't want him to give a speech.
Okay. I'm not giving any speeches.
Right.
But I think he needed to be recognized.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. You're absolutely right, and no one's listening to us, but we recognize you. So thank you for that.
I'm good. I'll come down. I'll be in front of your committee, I'm sure, at some point.
I want my-